Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Ryan Sanders, candidate for the 19th Congressional District. We're going to be here talking about his run and some of the things going on in that campaign. Andrew Gussert, he is the director of the Citizens Trade Campaign. He's going to be here talking about the 555 organizations across this country, some 20 million people saying no to the Korean Free Trade Agreement. And again, we can't have these insane job-killing free trade agreements until we turn them around. Look, I am not in favor of any of the Bush-era trade agreements. None whatsoever. Also later on in the program, Mark Andreazzi. He is the business agent over at Teamsters Local 776. He's going to be talking about the Schaffner Youth Center and it's closing. What's going to happen to the workers, and more importantly, what's going to happen to the kids there? You know, we're not hearing much about that. I hear, you know, parents are going to be able to go down to Lancaster or Franklin County on a bus, or they're going to. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but they claim, oh, we're going to save some money on the short term. Good luck getting out of that contract, and we'll talk about that later on. Also, here later in this segment, we're going to talk with Mark Warren. Fire in the Heart is the book, How White Activists Embrace Racial Justice. And with that in mind, you look at a couple of the stories that the AP reported on today. An Army veteran arrested after a seven-hour standoff was charged on Wednesday with threatening to kill the president as part of what authorities said was his plan to ignite a war between Muslims and Christians to start the apocalypse. Crazy, crazy people. Federal agents arrested this guy, 50 years old, when he surrendered early Wednesday at his home after the confrontation, in which he insisted a bulky belt and three storage containers in his property were packed with explosives. Turns out it was something like silly putty. And the Republican GOP party they're trying to get one of their candidates who they claim isn't a racist. The Republicans will try to remove their own candidate from the ballot in a suburban New York congressional race because he wrote an article warning against racial mingling, according to a party person. So, you know, the question is, you know, you look at all of this racial tension, and most of us, you know, myself sometimes included, think that, you know, things are better than they were. Things are okay. Because we don't see it right in our face. It's not something that we deal with and I deal with on a daily basis. And to be honest with you, I think most of us are uncomfortable by it, which is why I think we have to talk about it, which is why I think it has to be confronted, and it's something that I think we should do right now. We got Mark Warren on the line right now. Mark is the author of Fire in the Heart, How White Activists Embrace Racial Justice. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You look at this question of race, and a lot of us want to believe that it's not a problem. And I guess the question I have for you, and the people that you spoke to, the 50 folks that you talked to, how big of a problem do they think it is?
Well, they think it's a really fundamental problem still plaguing our society. You know, certainly we've made a lot of gains in the last 30 or 40 years. But the reality of life for most African-American Latinos is still very unequal to that of other Americans. And I spoke to interview 50 white Americans who have come to see that and understand that and trying to work to rectify that in various kinds of ways.
When you look at the modern, this Tea Party movement, how much of what you see there is heaped in some type of racial distrust, some type of racial problem, and how much do you think of it is just pure anger?
Well, I think the things are bound up together, and it's hard to pull them apart. I think there's, legitimate anger at the problems that a lot of people in this country are facing, but I think the problem is oftentimes that kind of anger is scapegoated against other people. The Tea Party movement is almost entirely white, and I think that part of the anger and the animosity is directed towards, new immigrants into this country who, frankly, are coming for the same reasons that, most of our forebears came themselves, to try to find a better life for their families and their children.
Right.
So I think it's hard to pull those things apart, but I think there's definitely, racial animosity is part of it.
Because the truth of the matter is, I think this is a very difficult subject to talk about. I mean, I got to be honest. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I was one of the very few white kids in the neighborhood, and I often joke that we used to play a neat game called Chase the White Kid and Beat Him Up. I got to be honest. I learned at a very young age that it really wasn't for me. It wasn't about black and white. It was about poverty more than anything. At least that's my opinion. I'm curious what some of your research has found.
Yeah, well, I think that poverty is a big issue, and economic exploitation is a big issue. I myself grew up in a blue collar, all white ethnic neighborhood in Springfield, Massachusetts, and for us, a lot of the issues was around poverty and lack of economic opportunities. But even within that, what we see is that the economic opportunities are very unequal by race. Or take a look at the spending on public schools. I teach at a school of education, and we are spending, on average about half for the education of children of color in urban communities than we're spending on the education of primarily white children in suburban communities. And I don't think we can justify that.
Well, again, doesn't that come back to the poverty issue? I mean, when you're looking at the fact that, suburban school districts have higher property values, thus a higher tax base, because here in Pennsylvania, our schools are funded predominantly from property tax values and the assessments that are levied against the property in that district.
Yeah. So, I'm not trying to say that economics isn't implicated in this, but even if you were to try to compare, let's say, African Americans with white people at similar income levels, you would see very different kinds of things. For example, the amount of wealth that African Americans have compared to white Americans at similar income levels is widely different. The highest income African Americans have about the same level of personal wealth as the lowest income white Americans have.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Where do those numbers come from?
Oh, they're widely known. There's been a number of studies that's taken from I think it's taken from U.S. Census information. I'd have to look that up exactly. I cite that in my book, and I actually go through various kinds of ways of trying to compare white and black Americans at in similar kinds of circumstances economically to show that there still is despite the fact that poverty does matter and economics does matter, there's quite a bit of difference between the life circumstances of black and white Americans.
So let me ask you this. You talked to 50 white activists who work in the African American and Latino communities. What sense did you get from them of how the response back to them was received? Because I got to be honest, I remember people coming into our neighborhood, and it didn't matter if you were black or white. Anybody coming into your neighborhood, any outsider, was met with a level of distrust and dislike, I guess, if lack of a better word.
Yeah. No, that was definitely a theme that emerged from my interviews and discussions with a number of these white people. I picked people to interview who had been committed to working for racial justice over a number of years. So these are not people who, thought one day, well, racism is wrong, I'm going to do something about it, I'm going to jump into some community, try to help people out and then leave. These are people who have, committed a good part of their lives to this kind of work over a number of years. And I think one of the things that they've reported to me is that it does, in fact, take a long time to build trust. There's a lot of mistrust in this country along lots of different kinds of lines, as you said, but particularly along racial lines. And I think black people legitimately have seen whites And that was one of the biggest themes that I found in doing this kind of research, is that in this country today, one of the things that we're still struggling with is this large degree of segregation. For the most part, white Americans and African Americans don't have very many meaningful relationships with each other. We still live in largely segregated communities. Our schools are largely segregated. There are some places where people meet, but not too many. And even in those situations, people often don't really have a chance to work together, build trust and relationships, share each other's stories. And I think that's the kind of foundation that we're going to need to build if we're going to, overcome a lot of the racial divides we have today.
Right. I came from Cleveland, and to be honest, Cleveland is probably one of the most segregated cities in the country. With every little ethnicity had its own neighborhood,
yeah,
and never did any of them mix.
Right.
As a kid, now that has changed a little bit, as I think it has across the country. Or at least I'm hoping it has.
Well, actually, residential segregation by race and by economics, and just speaking of economics also, is greater today than it was 30 years ago. And in fact, our schools are more segregated today than they were 30 years ago. It's not a very well-known fact, but it's true.
Really?
We live in a still very highly segregated society. There's a survey done by the Gallup poll. Only 15% of white Americans say they even have one close friend who's non-white. That's pretty striking.
That is pretty frightening. And but here's the thing. The first thing that popped into my head, and I got to be honest with you, I've got two friends that, and I was going to use the phrase that happened to be black. I don't see them that way, but that's just kind of how it popped into my head as I was going to say this, as of some badge of honor. And that's kind of, that makes me feel uncomfortable as well.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the whole topic makes me feel uncomfortable. I don't like talking about my feelings on this, and I think most white America doesn't like talking about it either.
Right. And that, actually, to be honest with you, that is one of the main reasons I wrote the book, was to help try to provoke more honest conversation about these issues. I agree with you. I don't think we know how to talk about it very well. People are hesitant to talk about it. And, the roots of that, I think, lies in our history of, that goes back 300 or 400 years. We're still living with that history, whether we like it or not. We may want to pretend that we've entirely away from that, but that history is still here, and the current levels of segregation just feed that. People just aren't used to relating to each other in a normal way and talking about these kinds of issues. And I'm hoping that by writing this kind of book, I might at least bring some of these issues out into the open to have some further conversation about this.
And the name of the book is Fire in the Heart, How White Activists Embrace Racial Justice, is by Mark R. Warren. The first person who emails me today will get a copy of the book. I will make sure that you get this book so you can take a look at it. When you were writing the book, there had to be some things that just grabbed you by the throat and said, this is the reason that I'm taking the time to do this. And I'm curious if you had those moments and what they were.
Yeah, I think I've had many of those kind of moments. I think it's doing this kind of work. A couple of things I would say about it. Doing this kind of work is pretty difficult, and it was very interesting to meet, particularly some of the older people that I interviewed who maybe started out in the 60s. I interviewed one gentleman who had led the first march of white people in support of civil rights in Alabama in 1965, and 40 years later, he then ended up moving to Milwaukee, got involved with fair housing issues in Milwaukee, then started working for a multiracial community organizing group rooted in religious congregations. He's now working around issues of criminalization of youth, and it was just very moving and powerful to talk with someone who's been doing this kind of thing for 40 years through kind of a lot of ups and downs, and talking about, one of his successes is that he's still doing this after 40 years. He hasn't given up.
That sounds like a great story. Let me ask you this, Mark. As in 2008, we elected a black president, and I think most of white America wanted to pat themselves on the back and say, our whole racial problem is all that history is gone. It's wiped clean. It's the end. And then we see the ugliness that has sprung up around it. And, you know, I go back to something one of my old friends used to say. He said, you know, because he was an older guy from the South, and he said, you know, I think I liked it better when they had signs and they told me who they were instead of smiling and patting me on the back and hating me in private.
Yeah. No, I think a lot of people often feel that way. One of the arguments I make in the book is that, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, the main form of racism we had in this country was, you know, an overt form of legalized overt racism. That's shifted a lot. We might still have some of that around, but for the most part, we have a different kind that's a little bit more liberal and what I call passive. And one of the reasons why I was interested in interviewing people I did was I wanted to know, you know, how can white Americans, who I think largely remain passive in the face of racism, how can they move to care enough about the issue to take some kind of action? And I think that caring issue is very important, and it gets back to the relationships piece. You know, we can throw out numbers of how many, for example, how many black kids live in poverty versus how many white kids live in poverty. We can throw out numbers like, you know, less than half of all black and Latino children actually graduate from high school today in this country. You know, less than half. When we know that the futures really depend on, you know, going to college and to get a decent job and to have full access to citizenship. But to a lot of people, these are just numbers. They're not real people that they know and care about. And that's why I think this whole relational piece is so important. Unless you can find ways to bring people together in their communities, in their schools, in their congregations, in their unions, so they can learn to care about each other. I think that's going to be fundamental to moving people to take some more positive steps.
No, it's great ideas, but the question then becomes, how do you do that? I mean, how do you get past our, you know, how do you get past the prejudices that we all carry?
No, I'm sorry, I actually can't hear you. You're coming through so quietly on my end. I didn't hear that last question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess the question then becomes, as what you've said is, we've got to do all this organizing work. How do we do that? How do we get past our prejudices? How do we get how do we make those connections?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I found that people told me a lot that I interviewed is that part of the story is to get started, to actually try something. You know, to get out of your comfort zone, to get out of our, you know, isolated communities. You know, I teach, again, as I was saying, at college and university, and, you know, you can teach people in a classroom about issues of racism or anything else or poverty, you know, so the cows come home, but that doesn't mean they'll actually do anything.
Right.
And instead, if we were trying to find venues, you know, just take the first step, you know, try to work. If you're in a religious congregation, try to work with the members of another kind of congregation. Move out of that comfort zone. Find something that you both care about, whether it's around issues of jobs in the community or public safety or housing. I really found that people really learned that they didn't just figure this all out and then they went out and did it. They got started. They took one step, and it was through building relationships, taking some kind of action, that they found that, you know, despite our racial differences, you know, we have profound human connections across the lines of race.
Yeah,
I think to find those. You can find those connections once you start doing something together with people and having some meaningful conversations. So I think rather than trying to figure it all out first and going out and doing it, that we should try to find places where, you know, people can at least take the first step towards action together.
Excellent point. Again, the book is Fire in the Heart, How White Activists Embrace Racial Justice by Mark R. Warren. It's an Oxford Press book. You can pick it up at where can we get it at? Can we get it
online? Well, you can purchase that book online at various online sellers, including, Powell's book would be a union one, but there's also, Amazon.com, obviously, that many people like. You can also ask your local bookstore to order the book for you. And I have a website that has a lot more information and ways to purchase the book.
Okay.
www.mark-warren.com. And there are photos of the people that I interviewed there and also just other resources that people are interested in following up.
And we will make sure that we put a link on our website at thericksmithshow.com to get that there so people can get a copy of this book. Last question I have for you. What do you hope comes out of this? What do you hope that someone who reads this book takes away?
Well, one of the things I hope that comes out of this is that it encourages young people. I think that there's a real hunger and a thirst out there among younger Americans to to find new ways to think about race and address race in this country, find new ways to connect with each other. And I hope that the book, because, you know, they might be able to read this book, see other people like them, other white Americans who have tried to take a different kind of life, devote their lives to something that's meaningful and purposeful, not just, you know, consumerism and consumption. And then it might inspire some of these young people to take action, to get involved in their communities, to become concerned about issues of race, to build new kinds of relationships, and as a result, hopefully lead a much more meaningful and fulfilling life.
So we can truly be one nation. Excellent. Again, the fire in the heart, how white activists embrace racial justice. Mark Warren, I appreciate you taking time to talk to us about this. And I have to be honest, this is probably one of the more uncomfortable topics that I've picked up in recent weeks.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. Right back.
The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. On October 2nd, 100,000 or more people are expected for the One Nation March in Washington, D.C. Hundreds of unions, civil rights, faith, environmental, and progressive groups are uniting to keep the hope of change alive. AFT President Randy Weingarten.
The core principles we support are American values, good jobs, justice for all, and a quality public education for all.
Weingarten says the diverse groups combining for the One Nation March share a common bottom line about the American dream.
The bottom line is, when push comes to shove, we want the same thing for America. We want to work towards these ideals, not have a fractured compilation of special interests, but as one nation that works to ensure that all kids get a great education, that all Americans have the jobs that they need, and that there is justice for all.
Siemens has essentially pledged to give its current home country workforce jobs for life. Jesse Russell reports.
In a rare move by a major corporation, German company Siemens has offered an indefinite accord with workers that it will not carry out forced redundancies. The company said it has made the move because it is committed to preserving Germany as a long-term business location and sees every single one of its 128,000 German employees as important. In a statement, the company said it will use every possible means to achieve this aim. While the deal protects the $100 billion a year company's employees within Germany, it doesn't extend beyond the borders to the 275,000 Siemens employees around the globe.
New York City is staring down the barrel of a $4 billion budget deficit next year. Mayor Michael Bloomberg has called on his city commissioners to look at their departments and slash a combined $800 million from the current budget and $1.2 billion from the next budget. On Tuesday, he announced a hiring freeze, as well as hinted at the possibility of making layoffs. The Teamsters Union has picked up 40 new members in Oakland, California, the latest medical marijuana workers to unionize. The medical marijuana growers joined Teamsters Local 70. Earlier this year, 100 medical marijuana workers in Oakland joined the United Food and Commercial Workers. The new Teamsters medical marijuana growers contract provides a pay boost of $7.75 an hour within 15 months, a pension, paid vacation, and health insurance. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
State 520 Rick 1-888-520-7425. So it looks like no tax vote today. No tax vote until after the election, I guess. Kind of makes you wonder. This isn't difficult stuff, folks. I would have liked to seen Harry Reid bring that to a vote.
I would have liked to seen the Republicans stand up there and say, you know what, we're going to stand up for the rich folks because they need the money. And we're going to kick Granny to the curb. I would have, again, this is one of those things, it's politics. The problem I think that happened here, Jake, is there are some Democrats, some conservative Democrats, our Blanche Lincoln, one of them, who were saying, look, you know, we want to protect the rich people in the country.
Well, I don't care what she does because she's going to, by latest report, she's so far behind, she don't have a prayer. And quite frankly, good riddance. But this is another example why people are disappointed, disillusioned with the Democratic Party. This should have been a no-brainer. And here's the irony. I understand why some of them are doing it. They're afraid, just like with health care, that if they support this resolution, they're going to lose. Here's the irony. Democrats across the country are in tough races. They're behind. This is the one issue that the public says in large numbers they're in favor of. They're in favor of ending the tax breaks to the very wealthy. That's a no-brainer. I mean, it's obvious that Harry said, no, we're not bringing it up because he doesn't think he has the votes, and shame on the Democratic Party again. And you wonder why people are disillusioned with the party. Here's another classic reason.
What should we do? Should we hold this off? Should we give the wealthy the tax cuts? Should we hand out, $800 billion more dollars over the next years to the very, very wealthy? Should we add to the wealth class, our Forbes 400, our billionaire list? What are your thoughts? 1-888-512-7425. Personally, you know, look, folks, we're in a major economic crisis. It's all hands on deck. And what's going on is we're seeing the divide between those who have and the rest of us widening even further. You know, as John Edwards used to talk about the two Americas, there are definitely two very different Americas. And, you know, you go back to the segment we just had here with Mark Warren in this book that he wrote. For me, that's a very uncomfortable topic because I don't like to believe that there are racial problems still. I want to believe that we're one big happy nation, but we're not. And this tax divide is another example of the splitting of this country.
And this is a defining issue. This is not just another issue. This is an issue where there should be a clear delineation between the Republicans and the Democrats. And when you have Democrats that want to be Republican light, it's the same old political axiom. If you're gonna put yourself out there as Republican light, people are gonna vote for the real Republican, which is exactly why I don't understand the position of some of these Democrats.
Yeah, well, at some point we've got to be talking about how to keep some reasonable Democrats elected and dump the rest. Let's go to the phone lines. We got Dave on line one. How are we doing today, Dave?
Hey, Rick, I enjoy your show, and I think the issue needs to be brought out more and more, and it isn't, because most talk show hosts don't seem to hear it or know it, but I believe that all of our elections are being rigged, and I believe that most members of Congress know that. When we got this Patriot Act, when we got all these new high-tech people that know how to invade computers, know how to flip things around. Like right now, opinion polls suggest that we Americans want more Republicans, that we actually enjoyed what Bush and Cheney did to us, and we'd like to have more of the same. And I can't believe that's true. There, I know there's a lot of people suffer from very real limitations that listen to Rush Limbaugh and think they have a piece of the truth. But reality is, and I think most Congress know it, if you don't behave the way the big special interests want you to, they can go in and flip your election and give it to the other guy. And I think we just saw that happen with Castle and O'Connell in Delaware.
I don't know about that, because I have some friends in Delaware who did tell me that the Tea Party was very organized. Now, understand in Delaware that 30,000 people voted for her in a state of 900,000. We're talking about a very small but active group. I'm not going to disagree with you that I think there's some major problems with the way we elect people, I'm in favor of going back to the old days of a piece of paper and a magic marker. But I'm not cynical enough to believe that someone can just flip the switch either way they want. At least I hope that not to be the case. There are an awful lot of shenanigans, like we're seeing in Wisconsin with the voter caging, just like we saw in Florida with voter caging in Ohio. You know, there's a lot of irregularities, and we have to be ever diligent. I agree with you on that.
Well, I'm convinced of it, and I don't hear it much. I don't hear the news addressing it, but I do know that when they got this Patriot Act, and I don't think that most of the Republicans have too much character that they won't defraud us, to go in and steal our democracy, take away our government, to put themselves in power, to put their hands in our treasury. I believe all of that's going on.
I'm right there with you, Dave. I appreciate the call, buddy. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you're right on, dude. Again, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425 if you want to weigh in on this. Look, you know, you look at the election of 2000. When really it hit us right in the face that there was a lot of voter irregularity. And now we've been paying attention to it with the advent of these machines that have no paper trail, have no way to, really for independent auditing. We have some serious problems, Jake.
I tend to agree with you, Rick. We'd like to believe as a nation that this kind of thing doesn't happen. You look at 2000, I really think it was stolen. Now, that just wasn't the type of voting machine we used. There was all kinds of things that entered into it, but it was
stolen before the vote even took place.
Do I agree with him that there are forces in this country, including some Republican office holders, that if they were given the opportunity would seize power in an unethical way? Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't say that easily, but just seeing what happened in this country in the last 10 years, I think you have to come to the conclusion that that could happen.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow.
Our stat of the day comes from the Too Much Online blog. Too Much Online says, are America's super rich hardening to a permanent aristocracy of wealth? This year's just released Forbes magazine list of America's 400 richest, notes Wall Street Journal analyst Robert Frank, include only 16 new faces. Four of those faces belong to Deneen Avera, Scott Duncan, Milan, France, and Randa Williams, the four children and main heirs of oil pipeline billionaire Dan Duncan, who died this past March. You'll remember Mr. Duncan was the first billionaire to have no estate tax against his estate. This is the first time since 1916 that the billionaire class has been able to evade paying the estate tax. Now, you got these four, the birth lottery winners. Because they happened to get the lucky sperm. They are now on the Forbes 400. They did nothing else besides be conceived with the lucky little swimmer. And they are on the billionaires list. Never to have to lift another finger. Never to have to pay the taxes. And these are the people that the Republicans are in favor of fighting for. This is who the Tea Party seems to be marching in the streets for. The birth lottery winners. We need to keep those tax breaks for the very, very wealthy. Because after all, you know, they need the money. You know, they don't want to eat generic boxes of macaroni and cheese. They want the good Kraft version. I mean, when are we going to get upset about this? When are we going to march in the street and say, you know what? We got people losing their homes. We got the new job report just came out, lost a couple hundred thousand more jobs. People are losing their health insurance. People are losing their life savings. Yet, oh no, we're not going to spend money on a jobs bill. No, we're not going to invest in infrastructure that would put people back to work. No, we don't need to do that. All we need to do is more tax cuts. Get the super wealthy to have more money. And then, you know, remember this, because this is the GOP plan. And maybe you've heard it before, but if you haven't, here it is. We're going to give the very wealthy guy in the room all the money, all of it. And he's going to spend it. And maybe some will fall out of his pocket. And it's going to trickle down on us like freshly driven snow. Maybe you've heard it. You know, it's called trickle-down economics. You know, they tried it a couple years ago, 30, and it failed. So what makes us think it's going to succeed this time? I mean, I've said a number of times, I'm already wet. I've been trickled on enough, thank you very much. I would like to be able to earn enough money to buy myself a towel. But that's not going to happen if we put Republicans back in power. We're going to make that giant U-turn, evidently, because we're not engaged. When you look at the T Twizzlers in Delaware who put Christine O'Donnell on the ballot, you're talking about 5% of the voters. 5%. A very small number. So I'm telling you, folks, if you don't want to go back to the Bush era, and I'm not trying to scare anybody, if you want to go back to the Bush years, if you want to go back to economic policies that will benefit a few and taking the restraints off Wall Street, you got the choice, baby. You have got the choice.
You and I have both met some Tea Party people who are just average workers, average income. They're just, you know, working class. Well, but my point is this, Rick. The corporations and the wealthy have persuaded them that anybody on our side that fights for a fair tax system and fights these just atrocious tax breaks that we have given to the wealthy is somehow a radical and is a threat to them. And they tend to be on the religious side, and somehow some of them have this mix of morality, their sense of morality and religion, and they've been persuaded that anybody that fights these injustices is somehow a socialist at best, and you better beware of them because we can't let them come to power. And that's unfortunate. They have persuaded many of the people who are being killed in the pocketbook by those very tax policies that those who are fighting for them are somehow the radicals.
Amazing stuff. The Democratic Party came out with the Pennsylvania Democratic Party came out with a press release today. Here basically what it is. It says, it's been just under a month since Pat Toomey falsely claimed that he never advocated for Social Security privatization. But during the past month, he has made Social Security privatization his cornerstone for this fall campaign. Look, you knew that he was all for this. If you went to the Club for Growth website, his former group and the one that's given him a boatload of money, it's right there front and center. He even wrote it in a book. His belief, no matter what he tells you, is we need to do away with Social Security in the future, and we need a 17% flat tax. That's his belief. That's it. Boom, right across the board. And what you need to understand is if we privatize Social Security, and if we do it the way he wants to do it, which is to pit one generation against another, because, of course, you people, you know, who are collecting it now, you'll be fine. So come vote for me. You know, screw those kids in the future. Let them be insecure. Remember, Social Security is a anti-poverty insurance program. This is not your mainstay retirement. It is anti-poverty insurance. It is the amount of money that's going to allow you to retire with a little bit of dignity and not having to eat cat food. And what we've done in this country is we have said seniors, people who've worked their lives, they've paid into a system, we're going to make sure that when you retire, you're going to retire with a little dignity, a little respect. And I got to tell you, people like Toomey, people on the extreme right, they hate that. They hate the fact that you're going to have some security in your old age. I mean, I cannot come up with any other rational explanation for wanting to destroy it. Other than the fact, and this is probably very true too, other than the fact that Wall Street is a giant sucking machine that needs more food. I mean, it's remember that movie with the Venus flytrap? I forget what the name, Little Shop of Horrors. Feed me, Seymour. That's basically what Wall Street is. It's never enough. They have an insatiable appetite for taking our money out of our pockets. And it's got to stop.
I think, and we talked about this before, Rick, I truly believe this. Social Security, in their mind, is the last vestige of FDR.
And they're out to destroy it. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back with Ryan Sanders, candidate for the 19th Congressional District right here in the area. We're right back after this.
I'm a boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio with my
my microphone. I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Hey, Bucko, stop whining about this sour economy and start thinking about the plight of others. For example, arms dealers. You've probably paid no attention to the hard fact that the global recession caused worldwide arms sales to plummet by 8.5% last year, pinching the profits of U.S. weapons pushers. The only saving grace in this downbeat news is that America's glorious arms industry did retain its position as the number one supplier of weapons to the world. We still control nearly 40% of the global market, with Russia a distant second. But before you set off a mess of fireworks in celebration, note that the U.S. sales in 2009 were down by more than $15 billion from the previous year. On the upside, the developing world is still in a buying mood. Last year, such emerging nations as Brazil, Venezuela, Iraq, India, and Vietnam poured billions into purchases of military playthings that go boom. Again, U.S. dealers were the big winners, controlling a third of the arms trade in this robust market. The greatest news for American purveyors of killing machines, however, is Iran. This rising Mideast power has spooked the U.S. and Israel. So, in the vague hope of countering Iran's growing punch, the White House and Congress are about to okay a blockbuster sale to the monarchical rulers of Saudi Arabia. Some $90 billion worth of top-line fighter jets, helicopters, naval armaments, and other sophisticated war machinery would go to the Saudis. The largest single sale of U.S. arms ever. The theory is that somehow or other, maybe, possibly, sometime in the future, this escalation of military testosterone in the explosive Mideast might produce harmony. This is Jim Hightower saying, good luck with that. But hey, if it jacks up profits for our arms dealers, what's not to like about it?
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once, The Rick Smith Show. I got it!
That's the one thing I'm calling for this election cycle. You got to get fired up. You got to stand up and say enough already with the misspelled signs and the illogical sloganeering on the signs. It's time to have a substantive discussion, something about actual issues. How are we going to turn the economy around? How are we going to create an economy for working class Americans? And enough with the, oh, I just want less government and oh, smaller government, less spending signs from people collecting unemployment. Enough already. Enough already. And in the 19th congressional district here in the state of Pennsylvania, it's an interesting little race. You've got a guy who's the incumbent, sixth term, who doesn't really want the job. He has applied for something else, and if he gets it, goodbye 19th district. Kind of makes you wonder, again, why he's running. Again, another one of those people who, better offer, I'm out the door. Kind of makes you wonder. And then you got an independent in this race who, again, the misspelled sign guys, preaching this bizarre idea of government. It makes you wonder. But there are some sane people out here. And one of them is my next guest. He's the candidate for the 19th Congressional District, Ryan Sanders. Welcome to the program.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking time for me, Ryan. Just had to get you on the line. I looked at the debate you guys had back about a week and a half ago, I guess it was.
Yeah.
And I guess the whole show was stolen by the independent guy who basically threw out a bunch of anti-government stuff with nothing ever to back it up.
No, yeah, it was a good debate, but yes, he usually had short answers that said the Constitution was the answer. And you know, in many ways, the Constitution is the answer, but we have to, the Constitution was written 220 some years ago, and quite frankly, we have to interpret it. It doesn't tell us every answer we need for today's needs.
So let me ask you, as you're going around, I'm sure you're doing the handshaking, kissing baby thing.
Yeah.
What are you hearing from the people that you're talking to?
What I'm hearing is frustration. You know, everywhere I go, there's pretty much two things come up. It's the economy and it's healthcare. Those are two issues that are killing the everyday American. That's what takes most of the money out of our pocketbooks. In fact, we don't have the jobs that are paying us, appropriately, and we have to then pay for our healthcare. I think most of us know that the income gap between the richest Americans and the regular everyday Americans, the middle class, is the greatest it's ever been. And we know where that came from. It's come from consistent policies put in place by the Republican Party to give more to the wealthiest 1% and take it out of the hands of the middle class and the small businesses that support them.
You know, I look at this decision by Harry Reid here recently to say, you know what, we're going to push this tax thing, this Bush tax cut thing off until after the election. And I'm going, you know, this was an opportunity, I thought, for the Democrats to stand up and send a message. Look, we're standing with the working people, the middle class people of this country. And I'm sorry, you at the very, very top, times are tough. You need to kick in a little bit more.
Yeah, it's not even that they need to kick in per se. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the people bearing the burden are the middle class. So it's time for us to give the middle class what they need. And if you the problem is that the tax cuts that were put in place in 2001 cost about a third of the current deficit that we have for our country. So if we had actually saved that money instead of giving it away to the wealthiest 1%, we would actually have been able to afford the stimulus plan, basically. If it's about the same amount of money, $700 billion. And that's the problem, is that our poor leadership, which Todd Platts was part of from 2000 to 2008 and now, is what put in place the fact that we're in the hole so badly. And that's poor policy, and it hurts the middle class because we're the ones who bailed out the bank. So.
Are you finding that the people that you're talking to, because, you know, you sound very rational and very lucid, are you finding that people are understanding this, or are we stuck in this shouting past us mode? I've got my T-Twizzler slogans, and I'm on the other side, and are you finding that there's some room for discussion?
Well, there is to an extent. The biggest problem, though, is the Fox News bullet points. If you listen to the debate, Tom Platz went through that bullet point list. A perfect example is his now all of a sudden hatred of the cap and trade bill. The cap and trade was something put in place by George Bush first and supported by the small businesses, by big businesses, by the Republican Party, and it was a compromise that Democrats accepted. So it's stuff like that twists people's stomach and makes us upset with politics as a whole, because you see, here's Todd Platt saying one thing, but then 10 years ago he was saying another. That's what upsets us about politics, because they're trying to get elected and they're saying whatever they need to get elected. They're not saying what we need to get good, healthy jobs that provide for us.
Yeah, I mean, I got to be honest with you. I get frustrated with some of the politicians and this waffling back and forth, the say anything attitude that seems to be pervasive in today's political arena.
Yeah. You know, that's a great point. I have a second. Todd and I are in the writing questions for a local paper, and one of the very first questions we have, he brings up this point. He says that allowing the tax cuts to expire for the richest would hurt small businesses. And he says that half of all small business will be impacted. And, you know, here's the trick. He says half of small business income. And the problem is, what he's saying is that it's not true. It's absolutely false. Because only 3% of small business earners make more than $250,000 a year, which is what will be impacted by the Obama administration's suggestion.
Right.
So the problem is that there are small businesses qualified as small businesses. They're not. It places businesses like Bechtel, one of the largest construction companies in the world, that has a $30 billion income. They have a holding company that holds all of their resources. That holding company is qualified as a small business. So here's a $30 billion business called a small business, and Todd Platts uses that to convince us that tax cuts are hurting small business. It's an outright lie.
And I think that's the thing that upsets people, because we want to think that the guy that's representing us is an honest person and isn't going to try and deceive us. And I got to be honest, when I heard that statistic that you put forth, I had to sit and think about it for a second.
Yeah.
And then I realized that, I know a lot of small business people. I don't know any small business people who make profit of $250,000 a year, uh-huh, because that's what it is. It's profit. It's not revenue. Yeah. It's profit.
Right. And let me tell you a real quick story that may put in perspective. I have two small businesses that I run, and my businesses have revenue, and it's not profit. Revenue of about $400,000 a year. That would be 75,000 Bechtel. A small business would make one Bechtel. And that's what most small businesses are. They're size of mine. I mean, 75,000 businesses, that's probably all the small businesses in our state. So this is a problem that our perspective is being skewed by bullet points that are, quite frankly, just wrong. And they keep saying them as if they're true. And until we start calling these things out, until the people start to really understand that this is not the case, we're being hoodwinked. We're going to keep getting back in the same circle of high debt, because we're cutting taxes where we can't afford to, and we're spending money that we shouldn't be spending then. Result.
I agree. The other thing you brought up was health care. Most people that I talk to say health care is an extremely important issue, yet we tried to get the best bill possible. I'll say it again, I'm not happy with what it is, but it's a starting point. Are you finding that the people you're talking to are the ones who are screaming for repeal, or do they want to improve on this? What are you finding?
Sadly enough, it's almost identical to what we were just talking about. Same thing. Misinformation being spread again and again and again. I hear people saying it's just like the death panel conversation. It has nothing to do. Death panels were a complete and total lie. Nobody wanted anything to do with that. It was just a scare tactic to get us off the topic. Everybody understands that our healthcare system is good, but everybody knows that it costs too much.
Right.
So why don't we just get to the point? We're all on the same team here. We want to fix our system. We pay too much and get too little. But we have the tools and the technology and the capability and the interest to make it affordable. And it can be. Clearly, we can see other countries have done it, made it half the cost of what we pay currently. So why we're not, as a political organization, having a conversation about, well, what works, I don't know. The only thing I can see, and in fact, the only reason I know we're doing this, is because it helps the Republican Party destroy the Democratic president. And that doesn't help us. It's because people are still getting sick every day. People are still paying for their health care every day. People are, for the rest of the next 2 years or longer, however this debate goes, we're going to be fighting this. And until we start talking about what actually matters, the practical things, instead of helping, being scared to the end of the day, we're not going to get anything.
And that's what frightens me. And look, the reality is the Republicans are not going to be able to repeal the health care bill, but they can starve it. They can't underfund it. And again, it's what Republicans do. It's that self-fulfilling prophecy. They say, see, government doesn't work. And then they go and they work to destroy things, and they can go back and say, see, it didn't work. We told you it wasn't going to work.
Yeah, because you didn't try it.
Exactly. Yeah. The website's RyanSanders.com. There's a place for you to donate if you've got time to volunteer. I'm sure you could use volunteers, right, Ryan?
Absolutely. We need tons of volunteers. Democrats and independents know who's winning.
Right. Your phone is horrible. Again, you can go to RyanSanders.com. There's a spot for you to volunteer. Also a spot to give him some money, because these campaigns, they're expensive. And to get your message out, you gotta buy ad time. There's just so much, which again, if we had more time, campaign finance reform would be on the top of it. Ryan,
yep.
I appreciate your time, buddy. Thanks so much. I look forward to talking to you again.
Great, thank you very much. October 1st, we're having a debate at Shippensburg.
All righty, we will try to be there. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. Stick around.
Show, changing America for the better. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. On October 2nd, 100,000 or more people are expected for the One Nation March in Washington, D.C. Hundreds of unions, civil rights, faith, environmental, and progressive groups are uniting to keep the hope of change alive. AFT President Randy Weingarten.
The core principles we support are American values, good jobs, justice for all, and a quality public education for all.
Weingarten says the diverse groups combining for the One Nation March share a common bottom line about the American dream.
Bottom line is, when push comes to shove, we want the same thing for America. We want to work towards these ideals, not have a fractured compilation of special interests, but as one nation that works to ensure that all kids get a great education, that all Americans have the jobs that they need, and that there is justice for all.
Siemens has essentially pledged to give its current home country workforce jobs for life. Jesse Russell reports.
In a rare move by a major corporation, German company Siemens has offered an indefinite accord with workers that it will not carry out forced redundancies. The company said it has made the move because it is committed to preserving Germany as a long-term business location and sees every single one of its 128,000 German employees as important. In a statement, the company said it will use every possible means to achieve this aim. While the deal protects the $100 billion a year company's employees within Germany, it doesn't extend beyond the borders to the 275,000 Siemens employees around the globe.
New York City is staring down the barrel of a $4 billion budget deficit next year. Mayor Michael Bloomberg has called on his city commissioners to look at their departments and slash a combined $800 million from the current budget and $1.2 billion from the next budget. On Tuesday, he announced a hiring freeze, as well as hinted at the possibility of making layoffs. The Teamsters Union has picked up 40 new members in Oakland, California, the latest medical marijuana workers to unionize. The medical marijuana growers joined Teamsters Local 70. Earlier this year, 100 medical marijuana workers in Oakland joined the United Food and Commercial Workers. The new Teamsters medical marijuana growers contract provides a pay boost of $7.75 an hour within 15 months, a pension, paid vacation, and health insurance. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember yesterday we talked a little bit about the Citizens Trade Campaign. Yesterday they came out and said over 500 organizations were united against the Korean Free Trade Agreement. And again, you know, as we've been talking about on this program for the longest time, I don't think another Bush-era trade agreement right now in this economy is a good idea. Another Bush-era job-destroying trade agreement is the last thing I think that we need, and it's good that we're seeing groups standing up and fighting back, and that's why I've asked Andy Gussert, he's National Director of Citizens Trade Campaign, to come talk to us a little bit. Andy, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on, and thanks for highlighting this important issue.
Well, I got to tell you, I think these are the issues. Trade right now, to me, is the big issue, because until we settle our trade deficit, we can never even begin to look at our national deficits or our national debt whatsoever.
It's the most important issue out there that's not being covered, and there's a lot of news this week. I know that a lot of things are happening in this final week of Congress being in session, but as we go into the election, There's also a meeting of the G20 in Seoul, Korea. And even this morning at the United Nations, President Obama was talking about how excited he is to go there. Unfortunately, the president is pushing the same trade deal, the same text, the same negotiations that were solidified 3 years ago by President Bush. And Korea is saying, we won't change one period, we won't change one comma. So
well, why would they?
Well, it's a great deal for them.
Absolutely.
It's not a good deal for us.
Yeah, and you look at the number of cars that they dump into our market. And I had Byron Dorgan on this program not too long ago. And he said, you know, they're able to bring in 750,000 automobiles and just dump them here. And we're only allowed to take 18,000 over there, and none of them sell because
That's
the people
right.
the people won't buy them.
People are, I mean, to put a face on this, this is Hyundai and Kia. It's your refrigerator. It's your Samsung TV. They're making these products, dumping them, bringing them, you know, importing them into the United States, but we're not allowed to bring our products there. That's an unbalanced trade relationship that we have with Korea, and unfortunately, the Bush-negotiated trade deal solidifies that relationship rather than expanding our ability to do exports into Korea.
But the argument for these trade agreements, these and what I'm saying are job killers. The argument for them is that, you know, hey, we'll be able to take our products there, and it's an open free trade agreement. The borders will be open, and our goods will be able to compete with their goods, and it really sounds great. Oh boy, let's go compete. But the reality is, our products just don't sell there.
Well, this is a failed experiment. The Korea FTA free trade agreement is largely based on the NAFTA model, and we had so many of these promises 18 years ago about NAFTA, that it would cut immigration, that it would increase jobs in the United States and increase jobs in Mexico. None of that happened. It was overpromised, it underperformed, and it's time for a new trade model. It's time for a way to do this and expand trade in a more balanced way. And the Korea, the Panama, the Colombia free trade agreements don't do that. They're largely copies of the NAFTA-CAFTA model negotiated by President Bush.
I know you know what frustrates a lot of my labor friends, and I've got, you know, several different Democratic constituents, if you will, who are angry with the president that we're even talking about another one of these Bush-era trade agreements. On the fact that we're even considering a trade agreement with Colombia, where they throw union people out of airplanes, to me is unfathomable.
Yeah, I think it's difficult because Barack Obama was in favor of the Peru agreement when he was a senator. So he was never on the mainstream progressive left on this trade issue. However, when he campaigned, he made promises and commitments to labor leaders, environmental leaders. And when he made these commitments, he put them in writing and signed on the bottom of the form. They're at our website at citizenstrade.org. And these promises do not reflect what we're going to see in the Korea trade agreement. So there are a number of disgruntled people out there, and I think it might show itself in this congressional election when it's time to roll up sleeves and get out there and knock on doors. I think there's some people that might think twice, and this is just one of the many problems happening right now. I would encourage people to get out there, to pound on the doors, but also to ask the individual candidates, what is your stance on the Korea trade agreement? Ask them if they'll co-sponsor the Trade Act, which is an alternative vision for a better trade model that currently has over 150 co-sponsors in the House and Senate.
Well, since
go out there and work for the fair trade, you know, candidate.
Right. Since you brought it up, let's talk about the Trade Act, because I was going to get to that in a little bit. But what exactly is in the Trade Act at this point that has 150 sponsors?
Well, the Trade Act was introduced almost 3 years ago by Senator Sherrod Brown and Congressman Mike Michaud, and it lists what should and should not be in a good trade agreement. It goes through how we can develop a more balanced way to expand trade. These trade deals have been passing with, in the case of Peru, a minority of the Democrats in the House. So you have they can't even get a majority of their majority party. We need some kind of model that can get a consensus in Congress, that can get a majority of both parties. And I think the TRADE Act can do that. With 150-plus co-sponsors, it has a significant voting block that says, you know, this is a better way to structure future trade agreements. This is most important in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is 8 or 9 countries on the Pacific Rim. That TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, could end up looking like NAFTA for Asia, or it could end up looking like the vision of promises that Obama listed during the campaign.
Yeah,
we hope it's that vision rather than NAFTA all over again.
Yeah, I've often prayed for campaign Obama to return, because I'm not sure I'm thrilled with what's going on here. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Andy Gussert, National Director of Citizens Trade Campaign. We're talking about the Korean Free Trade Agreement, basically trade in general. Let me ask you this, because a lot of people who have accused me of being anti-trade because I'm against these bizarre trade deals where we basically give everybody else a sweetheart deal so that they'll do our manufacturing in the hopes that we'll get cheap products. Because that is really what it is. We have a globe set up on a trade export model, and they're all exporting their goods to us, the consumer of last resort. The problem is now we're in an economic problem, and people don't have the money they used to, so we can no longer be that consumer of last resort. So I guess my question is, you're not against trade, are you?
Oh, absolutely not. Trade is one of the greatest tools to bring people out of poverty, to help foster democracy, to open up new countries. But it doesn't automatically do that. I mean, if you have a hammer but you need to cut a board in half, you don't want to use the hammer. We're using the wrong tools right now to promote and expand trade. The NAFTA model is a corporate investment scheme. It's very complex, and it's put out there by a small handful of multinational companies, not small businesses, but these companies that operate across many different countries, and it's structured to benefit them and them alone. So you're not helping the small businesses or the workers in either the United States or in a number of these countries like Colombia. But more important than that is, you know, the PR aspect of having a small handful of people with a lot of money in these national corporations, as well as the Chamber of Commerce, go out there and say, we need more of the same. We need the status quo. Well, of course they're going to say that. They've made a lot of money off these trade laws.
Yep.
Caterpillar has benefited greatly. The company Caterpillar has benefited greatly by these past trade deals. Of course they're going to promote them.
General Electric, another one. I mean, you know, I've often said we don't really trade anything. What we're doing is we're buying stuff that used to be made here, and now it's just made somewhere else.
And it's not sustainable. If we're not producing items here, if we're not buying the items we're producing here, we won't continue to have the money to buy from China, to buy from Korea. I mean, it's just not an everlasting system. At some point, we're going to have to ask ourselves, you know, what do we want to do in the law, these trade rules, in these policies that reflect our values on this? Because we can get mad at CEOs and yell at CEOs, or you can get mad at a worker from another country, but that doesn't really solve the problem. The way we need to solve the problem is by putting trade policies in place that change the system.
Yeah, and I'm in favor of doing away with the WTO and looking at most of these trade agreements and saying, you know what, you guys have had sweetheart deals for too long. It's time that we have open mutual trade. Because the countries that we're similar to, that have similar environmental laws, that have similar wage structures, that have, you know, similar social constraints that we have, we compete against very well, and it's mutually beneficial. It's these countries that businesses can go to exploit labor or to, you know, destroy the environment. That's where we seem to be falling way behind.
If you had to run a business on Main Street and the business right next to you could do the 10 or 11 things that China gets to do that we don't, which is ignore any environmental conditions, ignore labor rights, manipulate currency, not have to pay attention to intellectual property law. Each of those gives an advantage to them. And at the end of the day, the idea of trying to compete on a fair playing field, it's kind of absurd. So what we have to do is chip away at each of those issues, and the best way to do that is through a new trade model, best reflected by the Trade Act, but it certainly isn't by passing something like the Korea Free Trade Agreement, negotiated 3 years ago by President Bush.
I absolutely agree. So what should our listeners do? What should Rick Smith do? What should our listening audience do to make sure that this Korean Free Trade Agreement doesn't pass, and the Colombian and the Panamanian and the whole list of the litany of other job killers that may come up in the next several months, especially if the Republicans take control? What should we be doing?
There's three simple things you can do. You can make sure that you ask any federal or statewide candidate out there, where do you stand on these trade agreements? And you know, go up and shake their hand, and don't let go of their hand until they give you an answer. If you send them a letter or make a phone call, don't hang up. Don't stop asking until you get an answer and some kind of commitment one way or the other. You can also do the same thing on the Trade Act. Ask your congressional candidates, your Senate candidates, your incumbents, if they'll co-sponsor the Trade Act, and they'll know what it is. It has 150 other co-sponsors. And finally, you can go to our website, citizenstrade.org. Right on the very top of it, we have a very slick and simple way for you to contact your senator and member of Congress and go in there and let them know we want you on the Trade Act. You know, Congressman Sestak is also a candidate right now. We would love to see him be a co-sponsor. Both of the senators from Pennsylvania have already co-sponsored it, but Congressman Sestak would be a welcome addition. Most recently, last week, Senator Franken from Minnesota co-sponsored it.
Well, I'll guarantee you this. Next time we talk to Congressman Sestak, we will most certainly ask that question, because trade is one of the things that we've had conversations about. And you know, I think he's coming around to the idea that this bizarre notion of free trade is not working for this country, and that we need a different model, so that everyone benefits and not just a handful of billionaires like we saw yesterday in the Forbes 400.
That's right. I'm glad you're covering this issue. It often makes eyes glaze over when you use the alphabet soup of it all, NAFTA, CAFTA, FTAA, but it's the most important issue going on globally, impacting people's lives every day here in America, that simply isn't being reported on, that simply isn't being covered enough. Right now, this week, it looks like the Ways and Means Committee is going to be covering Chinese currency manipulation. That's another issue where people just go, wow, got currency? I don't, you know, there's too much going on. I don't want to pay attention to that. But it's one of the most important issues to figuring out whether you'll have job security in the future, whether you'll have your wages suppressed because your boss is trying to say, well, we need to compete with people from China. So these issues are moving forward, and anything listeners can do to contact members of Congress or candidates about it and be informed is welcome.
All righty. Citizenstrade.org is the website. Again, the job you may save by standing up and fighting back just may be your own. Andy Gussert, I appreciate your time. National Director of Citizens Trade Campaign. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for covering this issue.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." industry. Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Hello, I'm David Fillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
During a congressional hearing this week, experts claim that the decline in manufacturing here in the U.S. is risking our nation's national security. The National Security Oversight Subcommittee on Capitol Hill examined the effects of the destruction of the U.S. manufacturing sector and what it means for national security. Jeff Foe, founding president and distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute, said, quote, "We have allowed our industrial base to deteriorate for the last 2 to 3 decades. As a result, just in national defense terms, our supply lines for strategic parts and materials have been stretched around the world." Now, remember, in past we've talked to the politicians who've said, look, China comes in, buys up the company who makes those cute little magnets that make our smart bombs smart. And they make those cute little chips that give our bombs brains. We don't make those anymore. So without the cute little magnets and the smart little chips, what we've got are just dumb bombs. And the question is if we're going to be a war society, because we keep hearing the Republicans who, if they take power, will continue to beat the drum of war against Iran and North Korea. Bet your sweet bippy it's going to happen. We better be able to at least produce the things that our troops are going to need, at least be able to produce the things that we're going to need to take on the world, since that seems to be what our GOP friends want. Bob Bau, executive director of the AFL's industrial division, said, quote, "As you watch globalization move the manufacturing base offshore, in essence, you are moving the defense base offshore. This," he said, "is dangerous." CNN reports China's manufacturing sector is on the brink of passing the United States, according to a report released in June by the economic research firm IHS Global Insight. Now, understand, the value of the Chinese manufacturing products last year was $1.6 trillion, compared to here in the U.S. where it was $1.7 trillion. Every expert that I've read has come out and said, look, next year, that's going to be the end of it. Next year is going to be the end of the U.S. run, a 100-year run. Remember that, 100 years. We have been the chief producer of the world. 100 years. So it's goodbye, so long, farewell, Wiedersehen, good, all that stuff too. The nation's capacity to capacity utilization, CNN reports, which compares the output of U.S. factories to their maximum potential production, fell to a record low of 68.2% in June of 2009, as Chrysler and GM plants essentially shut down due to bankruptcy process. Look, we're not making what we used to. And at some point, we've got to have a plan. Not like the silly plan that we're going to talk about later with the Republicans in their illogical pledge, but an actual plan on how we bring jobs back to the U.S., how we build an economy that actually builds something. You know, build something. Simple stuff. John Tierney, Democrat, Massachusetts, committee chairman of the subcommittee, said, quote, "It is critical that we focus on modernizing and improving our industrial base to improve our economy, provide better employment opportunities to American, and strengthen national security. We have to start to think strategically about industrial challenges we face and take aggressive action to fully address them." Jeff Folk said, in addition, we have a national security policy that is not connected to our economic policy and an economic policy that is not connected to our national security policy. And at some point, Jake, I think we have to start having the conversation. I wish we'd had it 20 years ago. But again, you know, where's the plan?
Where indeed is a plan. And the report I have here in front of me, Rick, I mean, not only did we lose 11 million jobs, but now we find that when it comes to exports, we're actually better off export. We've been more successful exporting to non-free trade agreement countries. And they had a, you know.
Because you're actually trading stuff.
That's right. They had, you know, and here's the thing. these corporate interests aren't going to let go easily. Last week, they had the President's Export Council, which met. And they set forth their plan for more free trade agreements to be the centerpiece of meeting President Obama's goal of doubling exports over the next 5 years and creating about 2 million new jobs. The problem is the report that was issued by several groups, including Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, points out that there's a lot of flaws in the corporate research that they're using to try to persuade the Obama administration to follow through on that. Public Citizen says the unrealistic projections is that the nation would lose about $30 billion in exports over the next 5 years if these deals are signed, but there's more. Between 1998 and 2009, U.S. exports to free trade agreement partners grew by an annual average of only about 0.8%, while exports to non-free trade agreement countries grew by an average of 2.2%. Now, if you take that in terms of money, if the difference between the free trade agreement and the non-free trade agreement export growth rates for goods for each year were to be put in dollar totals, the total free trade agreement export penalty, in other words, deficit, would be about $72 billion.
Well, I mean, our trade deficit in general is in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And as I've been saying for the longest time, stop focusing so much on the deficits and the budget debt. Focus on the trade deficits and the trade debt. That's what's most important. We can, if we start producing, we can work our way out of the budget problems. Very simply, by producing things that others are going to buy. Or, you know what? Producing things that we're going to buy. Look, if you're the nation that has the most consumers, producing things is not a bad idea because it helps your economy. This crisis that we're in is a jobs crisis. It's a demand crisis. And the fact that we want to give huge tax breaks to wealthy people, again, a massive mistake. What we need to be focusing on is how do we get money into people's pockets? Working people. People who spend their money. People who have kids that need school clothes. People who have kids that need food on the table. That's what we need. People, families who need new washing machines and dryers. Families who need a plethora of products. That's what we need to be getting back to. Not going, here, go buy another yacht. Here, Paris, you know, go buy some more cocaine. Of that, we do not build an economy, folks. What we need to be doing is creating good jobs. And we do that by having demand. And that's where the government has to step in. And with, currently, with the Republicans that we have now, there's just no way. And when we come back, I want to talk. I want to take a look at this bizarre pledge that they've come up with. It's just another one of these fake, another one of these empty, ridiculous political PR stunts that, to me, is just an absolute failure. We're right back. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
We keep South Central Pennsylvania wired. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, right here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And for 93 years, we have proudly provided our contractors and their customers with the highest skilled and best educated electricians in the industry. Whether it's wiring a light socket in a Habitat for Humanity's home or replacing a vital component on a nuclear reactor, our professional electricians do the job right the first time. Our members are the backbone of our community and our nation, working to make tomorrow a brighter day. If you want to join us, or if you need an electrician for your industrial or commercial project, call us at 717-232-7093 or visit our website at www.ibewlocal143.org. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, and we keep South Central Pennsylvania wired.
Always by your side. Hey, Bucko, stop whining about this sour economy and start thinking about the plight of others. For example, arms dealers. You've probably paid no attention to the hard fact that the global recession caused worldwide arms sales to plummet by 8.5% last year, pinching the profits of U.S. weapons pushers. The only saving grace in this downbeat news is that America's glorious arms industry did retain its position as the number one supplier of weapons to the world. We still control nearly 40% of the global market, with Russia a distant second. But before you set off a mess of fireworks in celebration, note that the U.S. sales in 2009 were down by more than $15 billion from the previous year. On the upside, the developing world is still in a buying mood. Last year, such emerging nations as Brazil, Venezuela, Iraq, India, and Vietnam poured billions into purchases of military playthings that go boom. Again, U.S. dealers were the big winners, controlling a third of the arms trade in this robust market. The greatest news for American purveyors of killing machines, however, is Iran. This rising Mideast power has spooked the U.S. and Israel. So, in the vague hope of countering Iran's growing punch, the White House and Congress are about to okay a blockbuster sale to the monarchical rulers of Saudi Arabia. Some $90 billion worth of top-line fighter jets, helicopters, naval armaments, and other sophisticated war machinery would go to the Saudis, the largest single sale of U.S. arms ever. The theory is that somehow or other, maybe, possibly, sometime in the future, this escalation of military testosterone in the explosive Mideast might produce harmony. This is Jim Hightower saying, good luck with that. But hey, if it jacks up profits for our arms dealers, what's not to like about it?
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book title, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know,
the
together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion.
I gotta tell you, with the new plan, with the pledge, I pledge a plan. You're going to be waiting in a lot more unemployment lines when the Republicans take over. If you look at this, the big plan, the Republican plan, their pledge, kind of reminds me of that crazy guy from Ohio.
Entities and the principles of the National Republican Party, the State of Ohio Republican Party, and the Stark County Republican Party.
I pledge my undying support of the crazy people on the far right. Our quote of the day comes from one of them. Newt Gingrich said, quote, we should have a federal law that says Sharia law cannot be recognized by any court in the United States. The law will let judges know that no judge will remain in office that tried to use Sharia law. Am I the only one who thinks he's crazy? That we're going to have judges here in the U.S. who's going to uphold Sharia law? Really? I mean, does he really buy that? Or is it just, you know, Newt being Newt? Anyway, let's look at the grand plan. House Republicans today reaffirmed that they have absolutely no new ideas, absolutely no plan, absolutely no vision, and not surprisingly, no freaking direction whatsoever. The big plan was unfurled today, and the I Pledge to Destroy America plan highlighted the fact that they are a party void of any new ideas. It calls for more tax cuts and more mythical spending cuts that they refuse to name, of course, and above all, their disdain for we the people. The good old Plan Party, GOP, good old Plan Party, attempts to simplify policy into five different categories: jobs, government reform, federal spending, national security, and, of course, destroying health care. There are two lightning rod. Traditional marriage is there, man-woman thing, like that guy down in Georgia, you know, the African-American preacher who's being accused of luring young boys into doing lewd and lascivious things for jewelry and cash. Now, I'm not saying he did it, but that's what he's been accused of. And, of course, we need to prevent taxpayer fundings of abortion, which, again, is not happening. But, you know, like any good lie, you've got to continue to repeat it, and you got to give our friends on the extreme right credit. They know a good lie when they see one. And like broken records, they are able to regurgitate it at will. So let's go through some of the big plan, shall we, Jake?
Step up.
The pledge includes the following proposals: permanently extending the Bush tax cuts, all of them, or as Republicans put it, a promise not to raise taxes in January of 2001, the day the Bush tax cuts expire. So basically, we've got a party of people who they're going to hold up tax reform for the rest of us. You know, we're not going to be able to feel the benefits of it, but their campaign donors, yeah, they want to destroy health care. Again, there's no way that they can repeal it, Jake. They want to repeal and replace. So what they want to replace it with is the same nonsense that we've already talked about. Health savings accounts. Oh boy, we've got to have health savings accounts. So that when you have a heart attack, you can have three hospitals on speed dial, see which one's running the special that day. And then you can make an informed, educated decision with your last dying breath of which hospital you're going to go to. They want to end the stimulus. So the thing that saved the country from an absolute collapse, we want to destroy. Nice. They want to cap discretionary spending, which on some level sounds very good. Sounds great. Cap the discretionary spending. It sounds like we would do at home. You know, if our paycheck wasn't as large this week, you know, mac and cheese instead of steak. That doesn't work so easily for government, though. because there are so many variables. It's not like your kitchen table. People depend on our government. There are things beyond its control and budgeting process. But we don't want to talk about that because it actually takes some real thought. They want to dump Freddie and Fannie, which, you know, I guess you can make an argument on both sides. They want to rescind TARP. So they want to take the unspent money and they want to take it back, which, again, there's an argument to be made for that. We need new sanctions on Iran. I think we're already doing that, though. So that's really not anything new to be pledging, I don't think. Yeah, I think we're already doing that. And, of course, we want more money for missile defense. Well, wait a second. I thought we were capping spending. I thought we needed to, you know, tighten our belts and, you know. I guess not for bombs, not for their defense buddies. They need to require every bill to be available online for 3 days before it's voted on. I actually agree with that. That's probably not a bad idea. Let's push that. That's a good pledge. It's not really a pledge. It's more of a procedural thing. It's not something that's going to take an awful lot of work, probably, which is why they put it there, because, you know, they really don't want to work. Okay, so that's okay. They want to require every bill be certified as constitutional before it's voted on. I thought that's why we had a Supreme Court. That's why we had three separate equal branches. Here we go. The best way to save money is we just put all the powers in the Republican Congress. We can do away with the whole judicial branch. Get rid of that. We don't need it. Because they'll tell us if it's constitutional, because they'll have this vote, of course. And the vote will tell us. That's a good thing, right?
Absolutely.
On the jobs front, and this is what I love. You gotta read this. This is some of the most flowery, patriotic, jingoistic, grab my heart, salute the flag, do all that kind of writing I have ever read. And it's really, I mean, it is written for the simple-minded. It is written for the jingoist in all of us. And I got to be honest, I was reading through it and I was starting to tear up with patriotism and pride. In fact, I almost thought about voting for a Republican. Honestly, I did, you know, because it was just such powerful. I love my country. I just love my country so much. I do. Don't forget to buy some gold. You know, the people at, you know, XYZ Gold Company need your money. And while you're at it, stop job killing tax hikes, because that's their jobs plan. Well, we're gonna stop jobs killing tax hikes. What exactly does that mean? What are you talking about? We need to require congressional approval for any new federal regulations that would add to the deficit. So basically, anytime they're going to hire someone to oversee business, they're going to have to figure out how to not hire them so that business can police themselves, like they've been doing so well for the last 8 years. This is a great plan, don't you think? I mean, we're only about halfway through it, but this is good stuff, right? Are you kidding me? Of course, they want to repeal small business mandates in the new health care law, but that's kind of, if you stop and think about it, that's kind of twice, because overall they're repealing the whole thing, so why be redundant? Probably because they did need to fill 48 pages. So you're going to see some, you know, again, for cutting spending. So now you've got it, you know, in three different spots: cutting spending, repeal and replace healthcare. Again, they've done it again. Redundancy. See, I guess I can save us some money right now. All the redundancy in this report, just do away with it. In fact, I can save money and just do away with the pledge, because it's nonsense. There's nothing really in it. There's nothing really in this. One of my favorite things, and I had to read it twice, Jake, is they want to hold weekly votes on spending cuts. So this is how it's going to go. And maybe they'll set up like little, you know, like you work at like McDonald's or something, and if you come up with the idea of the week, they give you like a Happy Meal. This is how Congress is going to run now. If you put the suggestion in the box that everybody likes, maybe you'll get an extra pin. Or, you know, maybe a pat on the back or a really big campaign contribution. And maybe you'll have someone like John Boehner come and hand it to you right on the floor of the legislature, right there on the House floor, which is illegal, but, you know, he's done it in the past. So what does it matter? But, you know, they want to, and here's the thing, they've already got a name for it. It's called U-Cut. We're going to have U-Cut votes. And they're telling us that somewhere, they're not how, but this U-Cut program is going to cut $120 billion. So you're going to get your little congressman to run with his suggestion to the box and hopefully praying, you know, much like they do a lot of, with very little success, praying that we're going to somehow cut $120 billion to programs. Oh, boy, oh, goody, oh, goody, oh, good. You like your suggestion box? That's a great idea. A suggestion box.
Oh, my. You couldn't make this stuff up.
You cannot make this stuff up. And get this one. Now, remember. Now, remember what I said. There's a lot of redundancy here. So what they want to do is they want to root out government waste and duplication. You got to love this stuff. You got to love this stuff. I know I do. Cut Congress's budget. You know, I got to be honest. There's part of me that actually agrees with that one. On the defense side of their pledge, we need to pass clean troop funding bills, which I've been saying for the longest time. In fact, you know what we should actually do? We should pay for the war. Yeah. In fact, we should put that on the budget so we don't keep passing appropriations bills that never get onto the budget. That's what we should do. That's a good idea. And their other pledge is they're going to keep terrorists out of America. And you ask, well, gee, Rick, how are they going to do that? Well, they're going to keep Guantanamo Bay open. That's going to obviously keep the terrorists deterred, right? I mean, that seems to be the idea. And I got to be honest, I'm not a huge fan of Nancy Pelosi, but I got to give her credit here. She issued a press release that said the Republican pledge. She has put out the Republican pledge of, I pledge allegiance to the hedge fund managers of Wall Street and the consumer protections I want to take away. I pledge allegiance to the wealthiest of the wealthy who we will protect before the middle class. I pledge allegiance to the oil companies whom we apologized to with a recession and huge deficits for all. And I think that pretty much sums up the grand pledge. We're going to take a break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Give me your pledge. Tell me what the pledge. We're right back.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well?
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
A new
it'd be nice if the pledge.
It would be nice if the pledge were something along the lines of, you know what, we're going to pledge to help families that are struggling stay in their homes. We're going to help. We're going to pledge that we're going to help create jobs by stimulating the economy, by investing in roads and bridges and solar power and wind technology and all of the things that this nation so desperately needs, but has been held hostage by the party of no. And look, folks, I'm telling you, in November, if the Republicans take over, it is slash and burn. And Republican Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan, he's got no problem telling you. Right here.
We would cut spending right away. There's lots of things we would do. We would rescind TARP. We would rescind unspent stimulus. We would do a federal hiring freeze.
Cut. Freeze employment. Cut all the things that help save this economy. And that's what it's about, folks. Scary times. Let's go to the phones. We got Margarita on line one. How are we doing today, Margarita?
I'm good. How are you tonight?
I'm a little fired up. I got to be honest. This pledge thing has kind of gotten me a little worked up. Mm-hmm. I pledged to screw the middle class. I pledged to screw every working person in this country so that we can give more money to the wealthy. That seems to be what the GOP is all about.
Well, you know, if you pay attention to the wording in their pledge, they don't actually commit, even though the second highest rated polled issue was taking away tax breaks for corporations that ship jobs overseas. Do you remember that? 82% of the country polled very high in that. They claimed that they were writing this agenda to accommodate what the people of America really wanted. Well, I think it was 82% of America said that they wanted, of the people that they polled, obviously, that they wanted the tax breaks to be taken away from the corporations who are in essence outsourcing jobs.
Well, that only makes sense. It only makes sense that you punish people who are harming you.
Well, and I think it's really interesting if you think about it. How is it that the right wing of our congressional and senatorial offices have been claiming that they own the corner block on loving their country more than everybody else? But isn't it interesting that they are constantly supporting agenda that, in essence, means that they have to pay less taxes, the people that they're taking care of have to pay less taxes. And, you know, for a group of people that claims they love the military and their country more and it's all about patriotism and all of that stuff, do they not understand that it's the taxes that pay for our military? That it's the taxes that pay for their senators and congressmen in office and their pensions and everything else. That it is the taxes that pay for everything that goes on.
Yeah, they want it to be your taxes, Margarita. They don't want it to be theirs. It's that simple. I mean, you know, I do agree with the Tea Party people. And for those, most of them don't know what tea stands for. The vast majority that I've run into, in fact, I can only think of one that actually knew what T stood for, which is taxed enough already.
Mm-hmm.
So for those in the cheap seats who don't know, there you go, a little knowledge tonight on the show. But I agree, I am taxed enough already. People in our income brackets, people who actually go to work and punch a clock, they are taxed enough.
Well, yes, you're right. But one of the things that is a fallacy that I thought some of the news stations have actually been really good at creating actual data that shows that we have the lowest federal tax rate on average, even lower than what Ronald Reagan, the saint of the right wing, had going on. I think
his was
all the way up at, what, almost 19%?
Well, no, his federal was 50% top marginal rate.
No, I know, but I was looking at just the federal tax rate.
Yeah, that's the top marginal federal rate was 50%. Those were for the millionaires and billionaires.
I stand corrected. But the interesting thing about the whole thing is that right now, the current federal tax rate is like 4.58 according to CNN charts that they were posting just a couple weeks ago. But what we're getting slashed and burned on is when federal reduces taxes on their side, you realize that state and local levels have to pick up the slack for whatever federal doesn't support small town America with.
Well, you know,
local states have to pick up the slack and figure out how to, you know, make the ends meet.
It's the old saying that, you know, it rolls downhill.
Mm-hmm.
And it sure does. And, again, it comes down to the people who can least afford it. And as we talked about in the first segment of the program about race, you know, the minority communities, they're the ones hit hardest because they don't have the money for education. And we do a really great job of segregating them off.
Oh, I know. And, you know, the saddest part about it is that they are the most exploited in this whole situation. They're the ones being exploited by the financiers of the Tea Party movement, which we know is not being completely honest about everything. And the sad part is the poorest of our country that are being convinced that this is the way that it has to go. What's interesting is it isn't that they don't care and it isn't that they are stupid. I think that I get tired of people making fun of people that are low information voters. Most lower information voters, as I shared with you, what was it, the last time I spoke to you, a lot of times it's because they don't have time to listen to special shows that have progressive voices. They listen to what is passively available free.
I agree. Over misinformed is what I say.
Well, yeah. And so they are, in essence, Stockholm Syndrome patients. And I don't mean to say that in a demeaning way whatsoever, but when you're passively absorbing information constantly, day in and day out, you're going to adopt those things. You're going to actually believe that those things that you're being fed are the truth.
Especially if there's no one there to provide you with the opposite viewpoint.
Exactly.
Excellent point, Margarita.
So,
I appreciate the call.
No problem. Have a good night.
Thanks so much. Call again.
Uh-huh.
You know, here's the thing, and I think she's right on here. And I try not to beat up too much on the Tea Party, because I do believe that they think that they're under attack. I do believe that they think that they're doing the right thing. It's just that all they keep hearing, and like she said, passively accepting everything that comes, you know, just as I say, you know, they're just driving down the road, listening to the radio and absorbing through osmosis almost. There's no thought, no filters. It's just coming in, and that's what they regurgitate.
Some of that, Rick, I wouldn't give them a total pass. I mean, you and I both know that there's some corporate interest behind the scenes stoking the fires also. So I don't know that I'm not so sure I can give them a total pass. I understand what you're saying. But the Tea Party is, I guess what I'm saying is the Tea Party is probably a little more complex than we give them credit for. It's a convergence of numerous groups, most of whom are conservative in nature. Some who just outright hate the president. Others hate government.
And I've said, I say that
others are outright others are outright agents of corporate America.
And I say those groups have always been there. They just now have the corporate funding to pull them all together. You know, you've always had that 5% fringe. You've always had the fringe groups in this country. Now they just feel emboldened. And now they're able to step up and say, you know what? Now we're in charge because the media has given them that mantle. And you look at the election of you know, the fact that Christine O'Donnell is now a senatorial candidate. That is like their crown jewel achievement. And it was only 30,000 people. And this is one of the things I keep trying to tell my labor friends. Look, 30,000 people put this woman on the Republican ballot for a senator's seat. What could we do if we took back that kind of grassroots organizing that we founded? What could we do?
And you know, you can see that energy, and you can see that revved up devotion to the candidate. I mean, they were ecstatic, and you're exactly right. It looks like Labor did election night 2008. You're exactly right, Rick.
And we need to go back to that. We need to do that face-to-face organizing. We need to do that neighbor-to-neighbor, worker-to-worker, having these conversations and doing the hard work and having programs like this, interaction. We'd love to have people who disagree with us. In fact, if you disagree, you go right to the front of the line. I'd be happy to talk to you. That's what this program is about. It's about having that discussion. Again, 1-888-520-RICK. If you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Again, you know, This is why we need to do this stuff, folks. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith. Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. On October 2nd, 100,000 or more people are expected for the One Nation March in Washington, D.C. Hundreds of unions, civil rights, faith, environmental, and progressive groups are uniting to keep the hope of change alive. AFT President Randy Weingarten.
The core principles we support are American values, good jobs, justice for all, and a quality public education for all.
Weingarten says the diverse groups combining for the One Nation March share a common bottom line about the American dream.
Bottom line is, when push comes to shove, we want the same thing for America. We want to work towards these ideals, not have a fractured compilation of special interests, but as one nation that works to ensure that all kids get a great education, that all Americans have the jobs that they need, and that there is justice for all.
Siemens has essentially pledged to give its current home country workforce jobs for life. Jesse Russell reports.
In a rare move by a major corporation, German company Siemens has offered an indefinite accord with workers that it will not carry out forced redundancies. The company said it has made the move because it is committed to preserving Germany as a long-term business location and sees every single one of its 128,000 German employees as important. In a statement, the company said it will use every possible means to achieve this aim. While the deal protects the $100 billion a year company's employees within Germany, it doesn't extend beyond the borders to the 275,000 Siemens employees around the globe.
New York City is staring down the barrel of a $4 billion budget deficit next year. Mayor Michael Bloomberg has called on his city commissioners to look at their departments and slash a combined $800 million from the current budget and $1.2 billion from the next budget. On Tuesday, he announced a hiring freeze, as well as hinted at the possibility of making layoffs. The Teamsters Union has picked up 40 new members in Oakland, California, the latest medical marijuana workers to unionize. The medical marijuana growers joined Teamsters Local 70. Earlier this year, 100 medical marijuana workers in Oakland joined the United Food and Commercial Workers. The new Teamsters medical marijuana growers contract provides a pay boost of $7.75 an hour within 15 months, a pension, paid vacation, and health insurance. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Mr. Power.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember yesterday we talked a little bit about the Citizens Trade Campaign. Yesterday they came out and said over 500 organizations were united against the Korean Free Trade Agreement. And again, you know, as we've been talking about on this program for the longest time, I don't think another Bush-era trade agreement right now in this economy is a good idea. Another Bush-era job-destroying trade agreement is the last thing I think that we need, and it's good that we're seeing groups standing up and fighting back, and that's why I've asked Andy Gussert, he's National Director of Citizens Trade Campaign, to come talk to us a little bit. Andy, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on, and thanks for highlighting this important issue.
Well, I got to tell you, I think these are the issues. Trade right now, to me, is the big issue, because until we settle our trade deficit, we can never even begin to look at our national deficits or our national debt whatsoever.
It's the most important issue out there that's not being covered, and there's a lot of news this week. I know that a lot of things are happening in this final week of Congress being in session, But as we go into the election, there's also a meeting of the G20 in Seoul, Korea. And even this morning at the United Nations, President Obama was talking about how excited he is to go there. Unfortunately, the president is pushing the same trade deal, the same text, the same negotiations that were solidified 3 years ago by President Bush. And Korea is saying, we won't change one period, we won't change one comma. So,
well, why would they?
Well, it's a great deal for them.
Absolutely.
It's not a good deal for us.
Yeah, and you look at the number of cars that they dump into our market. And I had Byron Dorgan on this program not too long ago, and he said, you know, they're able to bring in 750,000 automobiles and just dump them here, and we're only allowed to take 18,000 over there, and none of them sell because the people won't buy them.
People are, I mean, to put a face on this, this is Hyundai and Kia. It's your refrigerator. It's your Samsung TV. They're making these products, dumping them, bringing them, you know, importing them into the United States, but we're not allowed to bring our products there. That's an unbalanced trade relationship that we have with Korea, and unfortunately, the Bush-negotiated trade deal solidifies that relationship rather than expanding our ability to do exports into Korea.
But the argument for these trade agreements, these and what I'm saying are job killers. The argument for them is that, you know, hey, we'll be able to take our products there, and it's an open free trade agreement. The borders will be open, and our goods will be able to compete with their goods, and it really sounds great. Oh boy, let's go compete. But the reality is, our products just don't sell there.
Well, this is a failed experiment. The Korea FTA free trade agreement is largely based on the NAFTA model, and we had so many of these promises 18 years ago about NAFTA, that it would cut immigration, that it would increase jobs in the United States and increase jobs in Mexico. None of that happened. It was overpromised, it underperformed, and it's time for a new trade model. It's time for a way to do this and expand trade in a more balanced way. And the Korea, the Panama, the Colombia free trade agreements don't do that. They're largely copies of the NAFTA-CAFTA model negotiated by President Bush.
I know, you know what frustrates a lot of my labor friends, and I've got, you know, several different Democratic constituents, if you will, who are angry with the president that we're even talking about another one of these Bush-era trade agreements. On the fact that we're even considering a trade agreement with Colombia, where they throw union people out of airplanes, to me is unfathomable.
Yeah, I think it's difficult because Barack Obama was in favor of the Peru agreement when he was a senator. So he was never on the mainstream progressive left on this trade issue. However, when he campaigned, he made promises and commitments to labor leaders, environmental leaders, and when he made these commitments, he put them in writing and signed on the bottom of the form. They're at our website at citizenstrade.org. And these promises do not reflect what we're going to see in the Korea trade agreement. So there are a number of disgruntled people out there, and I think it might show itself in this congressional election when it's time to roll up sleeves and get out there and knock on doors. I think there's some people that might think twice, and this is just one of the many problems happening right now. I would encourage people to get out there, to pound on the doors, but also to ask the individual candidates, what is your stance on the Korea trade agreement? Ask them if they'll co-sponsor the Trade Act, which is an alternative vision for a better trade model that currently has over 150 co-sponsors in the House and Senate.
Well, since you
go up there and work for the fair trade, you know, candidate.
Right. Since you brought it up, let's talk about the Trade Act, because I was going to get to that in a little bit. But what exactly is in the Trade Act at this point that has 150 sponsors?
Well, the Trade Act was introduced almost 3 years ago by Senator Sherrod Brown and Congressman Mike Michaud, and it lists what should and should not be in a good trade agreement. It goes through how we can develop a more balanced way to expand trade. These trade deals have been passing with, in the case of Peru, a minority of the Democrats in the House. So you have they can't even get a majority of their majority party. We need some kind of model that can get a consensus in Congress, that can get a majority of both parties. And I think the TRADE Act can do that. With 150-plus co-sponsors, it has a significant, it says, you know, this is a better future treatment. This is most important in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is 8 or 9 countries on the Pacific Rim. That TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, could end up looking like NAFTA for Asia, or it could end up looking like the Vision of Promises that Obama listed during the campaign.
Yeah,
I hope it's that vision rather than NAFTA all over again.
Yeah, I've often prayed for campaign Obama to return, because I'm not sure I'm thrilled with what's going on here. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Andy Gussert, National Director of Citizens Trade Campaign. We're talking about the Korean Free Trade Agreement, basically trade in general. Let me ask you this, because a lot of people who have accused me of being anti-trade because I'm against these bizarre trade deals where we basically give everybody else a sweetheart deal so that they'll do our manufacturing in the hopes that we'll get cheap products. Because that is really what it is. We have a globe set up on a trade export model, and they're all exporting their goods to us, the consumer of last resort. The problem is now we're in an economic problem, and people don't have the money they used to. So we can no longer be that consumer of last resort. So I guess my question is, you're not against trade, are you?
Oh, absolutely not. Trade is one of the greatest tools to bring people out of poverty, to help foster democracy, to open up new countries. But it doesn't automatically do that. I mean, if you have a hammer but you need to cut a board in half, you don't want to use the hammer. We're using the wrong tools right now to promote and expand trade. The NAFTA model is a corporate investment scheme. It's very complex, and it's put out there by a small handful of multinational companies, not small businesses, but companies that operate across many different countries, and it's structured to benefit them and them alone. So you're not helping the small businesses or the workers in either the United States or in a number of these countries like Colombia. But more important than that is, you know, the PR aspect of having a small handful of people with a lot of money in these national corporations, as well as the Chamber of Commerce, go out there and say, we need more of the same. We need the status quo. Well, of course they're going to say that. They've made a lot of money off these trade laws. Caterpillar has benefited greatly. The company Caterpillar has benefited greatly by these past trade deals. Of course they're going to promote them.
General Electric, another one. I mean, you know, I've often said we don't really trade anything. What we're doing is we're buying stuff that used to be made here, and now it's just made somewhere else.
And it's not sustainable. If we're not producing items here, if we're not buying the items we're producing here, we won't continue to have the money to buy from China, to buy from Korea. I mean, it's just not an everlasting system. At some point, we're going to have to ask ourselves, you know, what do we want to do in the law, these trade rules, in these policies that reflect our values on this? Because we can get mad at CEOs and yell at CEOs, or you can get mad at a worker from another country, but that doesn't really solve the problem. The way we need to solve the problem is by putting trade policies in place that change the system.
Yeah, and I'm in favor of doing away with the WTO and looking at most of these trade agreements and saying, you know what, you guys have had sweetheart deals for too long. It's time that we have open mutual trade. Because the countries that we're similar to, that have similar environmental laws, that have similar wage structures, that have, you know, similar social constraints that we have, we compete against very well, and it's mutually beneficial. It's these countries that businesses can go to exploit labor or to, you know, destroy the environment. That's where we seem to be falling way behind.
If you had to run a business on Main Street and the business right next to you could do the 10 or 11 things that China gets to do that we don't, which is ignore any environmental conditions, ignore labor rights, manipulate currency, not have to pay attention to intellectual property law. Each of those gives an advantage to them. And at the end of the day, the idea of trying to compete on a fair playing field is kind of absurd.
Yeah.
So what we have to do is chip away at each of those issues. And the best way to do that is through a new trade model, best reflected by the Trade Act, but it certainly isn't by passing something like the Korea Free Trade Agreement, negotiated 3 years ago by President Bush.
I absolutely agree. So what should our listeners do? What should Rick Smith do? What should our listening audience do to A, make sure that this Korean Free Trade Agreement doesn't pass, and the Colombian and the Panamanian and the whole list of the litany of other job killers that may come up in the next several months, especially if the Republicans take control, what should we be doing?
There's three simple things you can do. You can make sure that you ask any federal or statewide candidate out there, where do you stand on these trade agreements? And you know, go up and shake their hand, and don't let go of their hand until they give you an answer. If you send them a letter or make a phone call, don't hang up. Don't stop asking until you get an answer and some kind of commitment one way or the other. You can also do the same thing on the Trade Act. Ask your congressional candidates, your Senate candidates, your incumbents, if they'll co-sponsor the Trade Act. And they'll know what it is. It has 150 other co-sponsors. And finally, you can go to our website, citizenstrade.org. Right on the very top of it, we have a very slick and simple way for you to contact your senator and member of Congress and go in there and let them know we want you on the Trade Act. You know, Congressman Sestak is also a candidate right now. We would love to see him be a co-sponsor. Both of the senators from Pennsylvania have already co-sponsored it, but Congressman Sestak would be a welcome addition. Most recently, last week, Senator Franken from Minnesota co-sponsored it.
Well, I'll guarantee you this. Next time we talk to Congressman Sestak, we will most certainly ask that question, because trade is one of the things that we've had conversations about. And you know, I think he's coming around to the idea that this bizarre notion of free trade is not working for this country, and that we need a different model so that everyone benefits and not just a handful of billionaires like we saw yesterday in the Forbes 400.
That's right. And I'm glad you're covering this issue. It often makes eyes glaze over when you use the alphabet soup of it all, NAFTA, CAFTA, FTAA. But it's the most important issue going on globally, impacting people's lives every day here in America, that simply isn't being reported on, that simply isn't being covered enough. Right now, this week, it looks like the Ways and Means Committee is going to be covering Chinese currency manipulation. That's another issue where people just go, wow, currency, I don't, you know, there's too much going on, I don't want to pay attention to that. But it's one of the most important issues to figuring out whether you'll have job security in the future, whether you'll have your wages suppressed because your boss is trying to say, well, we need to compete with people from China. So these issues are moving forward, and anything listeners can do to contact members of Congress or candidates about it and be informed is welcome.
All righty. Citizenstrade.org is the website. Again, the job you may save by standing up and fighting back just may be your own. Andy Gussert, I appreciate your time, National Director of Citizens Trade Campaign. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for covering this issue.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, it should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry. Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
The one thing I can guarantee, if there are cookies there, Jake's going to be there. He will absolutely show up for free cookies. In a show that money trumps all, a group called the Log Cabin Republicans, and now you'll understand that these are gay Republicans, which, you know, kind of oxymoron. Kind of makes you wonder. But again, back to the idea that money trumps all. The Log Cabin Republicans honored Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, at a dinner banquet at the National Republican Club on Capitol Hill, even though he voted against repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The group also honored five other Republicans, Texas Republican Pete Sessions, Ileana Ross Lichtman of Florida, Ann Joseph Chow of Louisiana, Judy Biggert of Illinois, and Charles Dwyer of Hawaii. Cornyn, interestingly enough, the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Commission, he didn't bother showing up. Neither did Pete Sessions, Republican from Texas, the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee. But Cornyn and his wife, they attended a private reception that was closed to the press beforehand, according to the spokeswoman for the Log Cabin Republicans, Melissa Kennedy. Sessions was not there either. But you know what I find interesting? He wouldn't come to the main gala. He wouldn't come where all the other log cabinites were. I guess the first thing that popped into my head was closeted Republican. He'll go and he'll court them in the closet. But he won't be seen in public with them. Kind of makes you wonder. Over plates, the Hill reports over plates of chicken, mashed potatoes, and green beans, the Republican lawmakers invoked the legacies of President Lincoln and Reagan. I'm sure they were right there with the log cabin Republicans, with many speaking about their own hardships of discrimination. Chow, he said that He supports Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Told the crowd that he's the only Vietnamese American serving in the House, and he knows firsthand what it means to overcome obstacles. Bigert, she spoke of her years at Stanford as one of only three women. And she said, you know, it was pretty good pickings to get a husband or a boyfriend. Pretty good pickings. She said that women, that just like women got suffrage, the gay community would eventually get their right to serve in the military. And I was hoping to see her say, so that you'll have the pick of men when you get into the service. But she didn't say that. Anyway, the other one, Rose Letton, she said the first Republican to join the House Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Caucus. Is she like the only one? She's like the Michelle Bachmann, who's the Tea Party Caucus chairperson and sole member. Okay, folks, tomorrow, evidently there's going to be some kind of a protest. John Boehner, whichever it is, the guy who's the Republican House leader, he's going to be here in Harrisburg for the Grand Obstructionist Party dinner, 7 o'clock at 1 North 2nd Street in Harrisburg. I understand at the Hilton, I understand at 4:30 they're going to have a little welcoming committee to say hello and tell them what they think of the tan man. So, you know, you can have a quick conversation with Mr. Tan. Let's go to the phone lines. We got Mike on line one. How are we doing today, Mike?
Hi, Rick. How you doing?
I'm fantastic.
Hey, I was listening to the discussion about free trade.
Okay.
Don't know if you know it. There was a Hollywood producer, fairly famous, made some big movies, named Aaron Russo. In his latter days, he became an activist against free trade and such. And one of the things he did back when Bob Dole finally decided to come into the camp and say, yeah, we're going to do this, he made the statement like, we've read this bill and we can live with this trade bill. And Rousseau took the bill and put it in a wheelbarrow. He had a film clip. And the guy would come out on stage with a wheelbarrow and dump the bill. And it made a pile about 3 feet high and about 5 feet across. And he would say, you know, Bob Dole didn't read this bill, nor did anybody else.
Nope.
And that really is the truth of it.
And
this was delivered to the Congress, written by vested interests, and basically handed over the sovereignty of the United States to the corporate elite. It was in every way a coup d'etat.
No, I absolutely agree with you. These trade policies are just insane, and nobody read them. And you're right. And one of the things I do agree with the Tea Party people and with the Grand Pledge is that we should have people who are at least reading these bills before they vote on them. Maybe not at the Rand Paul pace of 20 pages per day, but we should be reading them at least.
Well, and they aren't, and that's part of the deal. That's part of the deal. When these vested interests meet with the representatives, they tell them what they want them to hear. And if you want the money to keep flowing into your campaign fund and you want to keep getting and inviting to the right parties and the dinners and so forth, you're just going to get in and pass this for us because that's what you have to do to stay in the club.
Yeah, that's what worries me about the president, because we shouldn't even be talking about passing the Colombian Free Trade Agreement or the Colombian or the Korean Free Trade Agreement as it's written. We shouldn't even be having that discussion.
Basically, all free trade agreements of any kind right now should be off the table for discussion unless it takes place between one of the 50 states. That's the only free trade, and since we already have that, we really don't need any more discussion. But I don't think that's going to happen because
nope.
I think the fix is in with this administration, unfortunately.
I got to be honest with you. We bash Obama a lot, and the reality is I don't think he could have done all the things that he said he was going to do. And I do think he's tried. I honestly do. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Obama is fundamentally a good guy, but in some ways I think he's out of his league. I think he is dealing with some of the most sinister entities on this planet, and that he can only go so far because there are greater forces than he on the battlefield.
Because the truth of the matter is, if you go back and you read about the New Deal, Roosevelt could only go so far, and that was to bring in the business leaders and tell them it was in their best interest to allow some of the things to go through in the New Deal. And that's the only way it happened.
And the only way he was able to achieve that was at that moment, there was a very real possibility of a true socialist government being elected and coming to power in the United States.
Yep.
He basically told all of his robber baron friends, go look at what happened to the Tsar. And unless you want to run the risk of having that happen here, you better get behind me, and we have to do something about what's happening to the working class in this country, or we're going to end up in a Soviet-style revolution, and you're going to end up in a gulag or worse.
Excellent, excellent point, Mike. Excellent point. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Yep.
We say a lot about the president and the trade policies, and I do believe, as Mike pointed out, that he kind of is out of his league. I when he was making all those promises and he was, you know, riling up the crowds, I did question whether he'd be able to do some of it. Going back and renegotiating NAFTA, like he said he'd consider, you knew that was never going to happen.
Well, and you and I both agree, Rick, that some of his advisors are without question too close to Wall Street.
Well, fortunately, one of them's going.
I was going to say, what's your take on that?
Good. Bye.
Well, again, what are we going to get? We're going to get something better. I hope so, but that's not a given. I understand that he's looking at Wall Street. He's looking at, you know, a corporate man. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean it's bad, but this point, we don't know who it is.
Well, look, as we've said before, part of the Great Depression was that there were so many desperate people. And Mike's right. There was a movement in this country to put in a socialist government. That movement is not in this country today. And it wasn't in 2008 when the economy collapsed. What we've got now is we've got people who are saying we need to go to more business, more benevolent corporation, more fascism.
I mean, here we're getting into a little deep, and I find it fascinating, Rick. Think about it. Since the Great Depression, when you didn't have these programs and the suffering was just immense in this country during the Great Depression, you did have a very real possibility that there was going to be a second revolution. Now, over the years, the very programs which the corporate elites have tried to block at every turn, there are some programs in there to lessen the suffering, so that the truth is not enough people at this point, as bad as it is, are suffering to even bring about an eventuality of a revolution, either a revolution of guns or a revolution of the ballot box.
Again, I don't think people suffered enough, which is why we're not going to see change. Let's take a quick break. We're right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Stick around. We're right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey, Bucko, stop whining about this sour economy and start thinking about the plight of others. For example, arms dealers. You've probably paid no attention to the hard fact that the global recession caused worldwide arms sales to plummet by 8.5% last year, pinching the profits of U.S. weapons pushers. The only saving grace in this downbeat news is that America's glorious arms industry did retain its position as the number one supplier of weapons to the world. We still control nearly 40% of the global market, with Russia a distant second. But before you set off a mess of fireworks in celebration, note that the U.S. sales in 2009 were down by more than $15 billion from the previous year. On the upside, the developing world is still in a buying mood. Last year, such emerging nations as Brazil, Venezuela, Iraq, India, and Vietnam poured billions into purchases of military playthings that go boom. Again, U.S. dealers were the big winners, controlling a third of the arms trade in this robust market. The greatest news for American purveyors of killing machines, however, is Iran. This rising Mideast power has spooked the U.S. and Israel. So, in the vague hope of countering Iran's growing punch, the White House and Congress are about to okay a blockbuster sale to the monarchical rulers of Saudi Arabia. Some $90 billion worth of top-line fighter jets, helicopters, naval armaments, and other sophisticated war machinery would go to the Saudis, the largest single sale of U.S. arms ever. The theory is that somehow or other, maybe, possibly, sometime in the future, this escalation of military testosterone in the explosive Mideast might produce harmony. This is Jim Hightower saying, good luck with that. But hey, if it jacks up profits for our arms dealers, what's not to like about it?
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
I'll tell you, there's something we really need to be doing right now. Right now, we need to be investing in renewable energy. We need to be investing in this country. I am tired of reading stories like this one. CNN is reporting the, quote, the world's largest offshore wind farm opened Thursday off the British coast with 100 wind turbines capable of supplying enough electricity for 200 homes for an entire year. The farm off the coast of Kent in southern England is part of a major renewable energy initiative spearheaded by the previous British government. Swedish energy company Vattenfall will operate the farm after having invested around £880 million, about $1.3 billion, into the project. British waters are an attractive place for wind farms because they are so windy, according to the report by CNN. As an example, an offshore turbine around Britain is estimated to produce 50% more power than a similar one in Germany. Of the 16 offshore wind farms now under construction around Europe, half are in Britain, according to the European offshore wind industry. In total, wind can supply energy to nearly 3 million British homes, according to Renewable UK, a trade group for the wind and marine renewable industry. And, you know, I got to tell you, you look at this stuff and it's frustrating as hell because we should have been doing this 30 years ago. We should have been putting solar panels everywhere 30 years ago. And what frustrates me, Jake, is we are at 1980 all over again. We are staring down the barrel of Reagan again. We are starting to make improvements. We're starting to move forward. We're starting to dig ourselves out of the hole. We're starting to move in the right direction. And idiot doofus America is going to turn it around, and we're going to head right back down the wrong path again. But you know what? I think of my buddy who was going to New Haven, Connecticut, from Pennsylvania. Ended up in Canada. He was going to go 165 miles to New Haven, Connecticut, made a wrong turn, ended up going, 600 miles up to Canada. And I asked him, well, why didn't you stop and get directions? You knew you were going the wrong way. Well, I was making good time. That was his answer. I was making good time. But you're going the wrong way. And that's what we're looking at doing here. We are looking at, yeah, we're making good time. We're going to be politically, oh boy, but we're going down the wrong path. We're going down the path of more oil. Funding more terrorists. Is that what we want as a nation? I don't think so. We should be investing heavily, putting people back to work. Instead, we got the grand no idea party saying, well, we're going to have suggestion box voting. Oh boy, woohoo! We're going to have you cut day. Woohoo!
Well, I think Ed Rendell deserves a couple kudos here. I mean, he has pushed for more wind power, and he has said if we do it right, we can produce up to 10% of our energy.
Okay, well let's forget about Ed because Ed's gone.
He is gone, and my point is
we're going to turn around and we're going to go back with the other idiot who's coming in.
That's my point. That's my point. Is this governor, and I think we know the answer before we ask it, any inroads that we made towards that? You know this governor is going to put up roadblocks. You know that's going to happen.
I pledge no taxes.
When you look at even the state budget, you know that there's some bills that they got to pay. They don't have any choice. For him to fulfill that, given the economic climate of this state, I mean, the number of state employees, the number of programs that he would have to cut, I can't imagine that even he would be able to do that plausibly politically. He can't do it. He's just saying that to get elected.
I'm sure he got a copy of the pledge. We're going to cut spending, but nobody ever tells you what they're going to cut. And I say, tell me what you're going to cut.
There's too many mandates in that budget for him not to. He can't do it. I'm going to say flat out, he cannot do it.
Well, I mean, you cannot have a philosophy of slash and burn. It's just not going to work. It's not. So I'm telling you that they're full of it. You know, their eyes are brown. Because that's how full of it they are. It's never going to happen. But it's a nice campaign slogan. It riles the...
It fires up the base.
It fires up the ignorant. The ones who don't think beyond the tip of their nose. And I'm telling you, folks, you know, our government budget does not run like your kitchen table. It never has. And we try to do it here in this state, and look what happens. We end up against a wall begging the federal government for loans. We still got to pay it back. Anyway, today Harry Reid moved up a vote on legislation that would give companies a tax break for hiring U.S. workers to replace overseas-based employees. The plan would also end tax advantages for closing U.S. plants and moving jobs offshore. It's called the Creating American Jobs and Ending Offshoring Act. Gee, that's creative. Yeah, that's the other thing. You know, you look at this. You know, Republicans always come up with really nice names for stuff.
They do.
You know, like Patriot Act. You know, it makes you feel patriotic, put your hand over your heart and say, yes, it's the Patriot Act. Uh-huh. I can get behind that. I don't know what the hell it is, but I'm behind it.
And how about the Paycheck Protection Act?
Oh, there's another beautiful
one. Wasn't that beautiful?
The Taxpayer's Bill of Rights. Oh, so wonderful. Oh, boy. It makes me all tingly in the panties. Especially if you're a log cabin Republican. Look. This bill should have been passed 20 years ago. The second the first U.S. company said, you know what? We're going to take our product over to China there, and we're going to build our product over there, and we're going to bring it back here and sell it. We should have said, no. No tax breaks for you. But yet we said, no, go ahead. In fact, here's some money to help you with your move. I hope you have a nice time. Anyway, it's Senate Bill 3816, if you're interested. And again, it's called Creating American Jobs and Ending Offshoring Act. Again, more creativity. Amazing stuff. Did you see this? The guy who has Facebook, the Facebook guy, Mark Zuckerberg, he appeared, I guess, on Oprah today, announced a $100 million donation to help resuscitate Newark's failing public school system.
Beautiful.
$100 million. I'm just so thrilled. You can just hear how happy I am that we're making a point of saying that this really, really rich guy who's worth almost $7 billion decided he was going to reach into his petty cash and you know, city lottery. Oh boy. Let's see how many charter schools we can get out of this.
I was going to say, are there any strings attached?
Well, of course there are.
And what might they be, right?
Well, I mean, here again, you know, this is another one of these groups who want school choice. The guy who sold him on this is the mayor His name is Corey A. Booker. He is an advocate of school choice, and he's been traveling the country, according to reports, meeting business leaders and celebrities and raising money for Newark. Evidently, Oprah is one of his big supporters and has given, you know, millions of dollars to the schools and other organizations there in Newark over the last couple of years. But here, what bothers me about this is that here we got this guy who, he's got some problems of his own. I mean, there's a movie coming out about him. There's some allegations around. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take a drop of a couple of pennies, like rich people do, take a couple of pennies of their wealth and say, we bestow the honor upon thee. And then they get a whole bunch of press cover. Oh, what a wonderful person. Oh, we love him. He's so wonderful. Oh. And it's a mere pittance, but we make such a big deal out of it. And then he gets to write that off. And then you and I pay for it anyway. So what I'm saying, what we should just do is we should tax him. Go back to a sane tax code. Since most of his wealth is begotten by capital gains tax, we should move that up. Here's a guy making, you know, taking all this money in, paying 15% flat tax across the board. Well, I know a guy swinging a hammer paying 18%. Explain to me the rationale in that. Explain the fairness in that. There isn't any. So I say we take that money and we fund our public schools, and then we don't have to talk about this. It's just done. Like we used to in the good old days under a really good socialist president like Dwight David Eisenhower.
You just love to say that, don't you?
I do. 92% top marginal tax rate. If Mr. Zuckerman were alive, the 26-year-old whiz kid Facebook guy were alive back then making his billions, our government would be happy to take 92% of every penny that he made over $1.6 million and fund schools and roads and bridges and hospitals so people could have health care and universities so we could do research. And all of those things that we love to say we were just so wonderful thinking of. We're going to take a quick break. Your calls to finish this up. 1-888-520-RICK. Right back.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair
Service. Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell we fighting for? Just surrender and want to die. Just got time to say your prayer. While you're waiting for the hammer to fall.
Well, the agency French Press yesterday reported, quote, former President George W. Bush's advisors focused on toppling Saddam Hussein's regime as soon as he took office and discussed how to justify a war with Iraq shortly after invading Afghanistan in 2001. Official documents showed Wednesday, a few hours after the September 11th attacks in 2001, then Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld spoke of attacking Iraq as well as Osama bin Laden. According to notes of the meeting on that day, newly declassified papers show. Rumsfeld told a Pentagon lawyer to go to his deputy to get support showing a supposed link between the Iraq regime and Al-Qaeda's founder, according to the papers posted on the Washington-based National Security Archive. They are an independent research institute. The U.S. government has since acknowledged that Saddam Hussein's regime had nothing to do with 9/11. So you look at this stuff and you go, well, yeah, no kidding. We all knew this, but here's the thing. These newly released documents prove it. It's no longer conjecture. It is fact. So the question I have is, what do we do? Do we follow the Nixon frame of mind? Well, if the president doesn't, it's not illegal. I say it is. I say we cannot heal this nation. We cannot heal this world until this guy is brought to justice.
And you and I both know that's going to be tough.
It's never going to happen.
In this political climate. I mean, since you brought the subject up, I mean, the truth is, since 98, several of the neocons made public speeches extolling the virtues of invading Iraq and setting up an American presence. And there are two big reasons. I know this is, you better sit down, Rick, this is going to shock you, to protect our oil supply, one, and two, to set up a better American presence in the Middle East so that we could better protect Israel. Now, these are their basic fundamental beliefs coming into power. And then you have the vice president who, for the first time ever, from what I understand, when the British and the American intelligence brought it to Congress, he interceded at that level. He was allowed, for the first time ever, to intercede and interpret anything that would remotely point to the fact that they had weapons of mass destruction. He was able to emphasize that, and he was able to talk down anything to the contrary for the first time ever. So anything like this doesn't surprise me. I think we were fundamentally lied to, and I always will believe that.
I agree. In fact, what you talked about is Section 5 of Rebuilding America's Defenses, something by the Project for a New American Century, entitled Creating Tomorrow's Dominant Force, includes the sentence, quote, further, the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one. Absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, which is what they got on September 11th. And you look at this and, you know, I guess most people are just going to go, well, you know, it's history. That was years ago. Let's forget about Bush. Well, here's the thing. We know now that he took office with the sole intention of getting us into Iraq. And here's the problem I have with this. As much as I have disdain for Hussein, as much as I did not like the guy and did not want him in power, he kept that region semi-stable because you didn't have the theocrats taking over. What we've done is we won the Iraq-Iran war for Iran because, mark my word, eventually they will, through theocracy, take that region over.
Well, I mean, when you look back, the absurdity that was that Al-Qaeda was in Iraq, the truth was Saddam Hussein would not tolerate. He would kill him or throw him out. He did not like Al-Qaeda, and he actually was an enemy of them.
He didn't like the Taliban. He wanted nothing to do with bin Laden. None of those connections matched. None of them made sense. But you know what? It's like any lie. They kept telling it.
And he kept the lid on literally centuries of that religious animosity and exploded in her face. If I can mention one other thing, Rick, which you haven't brought up, but I think it's a price that we paid for the Bush administration. They also had extolled the virtues of the Patriot Act before they came to power. And they hid behind 9/11. And you know when that vote came up, Congress was cowered, literally cowered into voting for that because very few politicians, there were only a couple of them, had the courage to stand up to that and be labeled soft on terrorism. And now we have the Patriot Act, and in my mind, and you probably agree with it, in my mind, in a whole range of areas, we have given up a lot of our freedoms.
And again, the Patriot Act is beautiful. I mean, the USA Patriot Act, uniting and strengthening America by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism act. USA Patriot. I mean, that's much better than blah, 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 whatever, stopping outsourcing and creating jobs with the other. They're just much better at messaging. Much better. And you think about the Patriot Act. They took your rights away. And no Tea Party person, none of the people who were in that were overly upset. I remember going to meetings. The League of Women Voters in Allentown had a meeting where they had three panel members for, three panel members against. And the three people who were against it actually read it. The three people who were for it, obviously, they did not. Which was interesting to me, because I kept sitting there, and I'm not somebody who gets all riled up in a crowd. I generally will fall to the back and watch the chaos. And it was amazing to me to watch the people in the crowd go to the side of the people who were not informed, had not read it, but were advocating for it. In fact, the woman that was sitting next to me was so in favor of a national ID card so that she could get through the airport quicker. It just made my head spin. She's going, well, why can't we have a national ID card? And people are going, yeah, why can't we have it? You know, the Senate is supposed to be a place where that stuff stops. Now sane people are going, well, national ID card, not a good idea. But after 9/11, boy, people were willing to just take my freedom, take it, just keep me safe. Scary times.
You had the Republicans who obviously unanimously pushed it, or the party of less government. Amazing stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we want government out of our lives, except for our reading records, our health care, a whole litany of different avenues for them to invade your privacy. Yeah, no problem. And all without a warrant. All without cause. See, nothing in the Patriot Act was there that they couldn't do before. They could still check your library records. They could still check your health care. They could check your bank accounts. They could check all that stuff. But they had to go to a judge and say, judge, here's our reasoning. Give us some latitude. And the judge would say, okay, there you go. But there was some semblance of oversight. This, yep. They say, God, sure, yeah. Well, in fact, we're going to let you go do it. And if anyone tells you that tells the person, they're going to go to jail. So my librarian, if my librarian tells me, you know, Rick, the FBI was in here checking your library card, she goes to jail.
Well, they do have to go before the judge. The difference is,
they do it retroactively.
All the federal government has to do is show that judge it's stamped security, national security. That judge does not have any choice. He has to give you. He has to give the local authorities or the feds for the most part, that search warrant. Doesn't have a choice.
Ah, the good old days. And boy, I can't wait to go back to that. Can't wait to go back to the Republican rule in the country, giving us less government with more spies in the skies. I just cannot wait. Oh boy, I can't wait to have my phone tapped and my car followed and man and my trunk checked all the time. But I'm looking forward to the police state that's coming. Aren't you? No, of course you're not. Well, thanks for listening tonight. Again, we'll be here tomorrow, 9 o'clock, right here. You can watch us on the RickSmithShow.com, or make sure you email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails. Thanks for being here. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.